720. WGN, high atop Chicago in the Allstate Skyline Studio in for Nick D until 5 a.m. today. You just heard ZZ Top, courtesy of the Quiet Storm himself, Tom Hush. And ZZ Top may not have been at Lollapalooza this year. And Dino DeBerry, to my right, the physical embodiment of all things Harry Carey and so much more, right? And you got to mingle with some other physical embodiments of themselves as well, right?
Absolutely. Had an event over at Joe's on Weed tonight, so...
So we'll talk about that as well. But so ZZ Top, they weren't there, but they were at, I think ZZ Top was maybe at the, did we talk about the, it was like Tribute Island or something where all the...
That was last time we were at.
All the tribute bands.
Yeah, up in Kenosha. Yeah. 58 bands in 2-3 days.
So question, let's say you love ZZ Top and who doesn't, right? They've got, you know, a bunch of songs and they're fun to, you know, kind of a fun band. So you maybe go out and get one of those cars, right, if you can, to drive, or maybe rent one during your performances, but do you grow the beard if you're in the tribute band? Because, you know, people are like, hey, nice beard. You're like, well, actually, there's a story behind it.
I think it would depend on how long you were actually the tribute band for ZZ Top. If you were, you're only 6 months on the job, you're not going to have much of a beard working at that point.
Imagine the audition, too. Let's say there's a couple guys, in the, and they're like, okay.
Who's got the better beard?
He's like, this guy's a terrible player, but that beard. Right?
You pull off a little Milli Vanilli, have somebody else sing, and they can stand out in front.
Tom Hush, if let's say, you know, this is the most hypothetical situation ever. It's a place you could probably never find yourself realistically. But let's say that you were auditioning, let's say you were going to be part of a tribute band for a band that you liked and appreciated, whatever, right? And let's say that band had a certain look. Would you go through some extra hoops to sort of physically resemble those artists you admired?
Yeah, I think so. I think you got to sell the performance, man. You know, if I'm going to go out there and be in part of a Simon and Garfunkel tribute band, I'm going to be Art Garfunkel, I'm going to get a perm. You know, I got to have the crazy hair. I'm going to wear the sweater.
You get the Sideshow Bob, like, super kind of big hair.
Breaking on Cecilia in moment's notice. That's all.
All right. Well, I like to see that. You know, you got to go the extra mile in the commitment. And so many did when it comes from not only the band side, but the fan side, right? Lollapalooza is there. And coming up after our first break, we're going to have Mike Heideman. You know him as one of our great producers here at WGN. I think he does sound sessions as well. And of course, he does like open mic nights. He's all over the place. So he actually does. He's a musician as well as a music fan and aficionado. So we're going to be talking to him about Lollapalooza. Dino, have you ever been to Lollapalooza?
I have not. I have never been there. And I don't, you know, I probably...
Because you're waiting for ZZ Top to be headlining it.
Yeah, I mean, come on. It's one of those things. I just have never... I don't know. I'm a little, at this point in my life, maybe a little old for that scene. But
they try to keep it. This is the amazing thing about the festival. One of the amazing things is it's right here in Chicago. So it's kind of had a checkered past from its inception until the stability of like the last, you know, I don't know, decade or something when it's been kind of right here. But it's a marquee festival, and they try to, you know, kind of have a lot of different music. You know, you'll have artists from all over the spectrum. Everything from just sort of dance music, some of the biggest artists from, you know, like a Paul McCartney.
You'll see
Metallica, and you'll see Eminem, and then you'll see, you know, some others too. So they try to have that full range. And since there is and seems to be a little something or maybe a lot for everybody, they're able to almost sell that thing out before they even announce who's playing.
Yeah, that's it. That's some good marketing right there. Here's a concert. We don't know who's coming, but go ahead. You can start buying the tickets now.
So you know the music is going to be great. We talked about it over the weekend on the road as well. The food situation is really good. They were one of those early festivals that kind of curated the food scene away from, you know, your concession stand food, you know, where it wasn't just like nachos. Yeah. You know, they had like great, you know,
local restaurants come in and do their thing.
Restaurants and celebrity chefs and all that. So you're going to have great food. You're going to have great music. But the event itself is so big, and there's so much that goes along with having all those hundreds of thousands of people over the course of days. One death, 4 arrests, 30 hospital transfers, and so we'll talk with Mike about that stuff as well. So when we come back, we're going to have more with that. Plus, coming up at 2 o'clock, Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. We're going to talk the greatest action movies of all time, plus some really big ones. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a big movie that's out right now. And so your thoughts as well. And here's the ones that you can kind of share in Nick D style. 312-981-7200. Your favorite action movie or action star of all time. We talked with Carl and Lisa a little bit about that. And then we stumbled into, and good thing we didn't fall on a sharpened pickup stick.
That wouldn't have been too good.
Which was deemed as dangerous. Is your most dangerous toy or toys that you had that maybe you had back in the day that are worth something now? Or those dangerous toys, things that you couldn't see on a shelf or with kids today. So a quick break. We'll be back. It's Dane here in for Nick, 720 WGN. Hi, it's Tom Chicago, Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick T. Tom Hush, the Quiet Storm, in the booth. And to my right, Dino Tavares, right, Shotgun. And on the line with us, we're going to ask him a lot about Lollapalooza, but also, too, is a recurring theme that you can add to as well. 312-981-7200, your most dangerous toy that you've ever had. Mike Heideman, got to give him a proper introduction. He's one of our great producers here. He's the host of Sound Sessions Podcast, a music aficionado who not only talks the talk, but also walks the walk. You can see him in and around Chicago at some great venues, singing his way into your heart. Mike Heideman, welcome to WGN.
Dane, it is great to be speaking with you. And by the way, most dangerous toy, definitely the Pog Slammer back in the day. That was one of the
Pog Slammer. Oh my gosh. Okay, so here it is, and we'll get right to it. Is as much as there is at Lollapalooza, it is a thing that people look forward to all year long, and people come from around the world to attend it. But on the dangerous side, too, what do you attribute it to? Is it the fact that we were talking about it off there. It's a very long day. You know, people are imbibing. There's so many people, right? Maybe it's too crowded, but, there was a lot of issues, you know, with people going to the hospital. I guess even a person died.
Oh, yes. Well, for any city that's putting on a festival of this size, you got to take a lot into account. I mean, there's over 100,000 people a day that are coming to Lollapalooza here in Chicago, and that means extended work hours for police. The amount of safety and security you can provide can only be accounted for as far as people taking care of themselves. And if you're coming to Lollapalooza to drink and to hang out, that's all fine and dandy. But at least stay hydrated and get yourself in accordance with the safety structures that they've built. There's hydration stations all around the area. There's places you can go with first aid tents and everything. And I did read about the one person that sadly passed away. And it's just a matter of, you know, coming here and kind of playing by the rules, because at the same time, you see that there was an uptick in some of the arrests that were going on. There were some viral videos that went on where people were jumping the fence. And actually, I looked into the police blotter about how much crime had been happening. And even though it's always, you know, you're ready to have some people arrested during the festival, it's just always shocking to see. So it's sad to see that some people, you know, they went through those issues, but it's hard to maintain a 4-day festival that over 100,000 people come to in just like 2 miles of square blockage in Chicago.
Yeah, and so maybe you look at that and it just kind of goes with the territory. And I think part of it isn't the people are trying to storm the fences and jump over it is you know, supply and demand. There's a certain amount of tickets. They are kind of expensive. It's a pricey event, and you know, there's a lot of people that want to go and see it. So let's talk a little bit about the music. We talked before we got you on that it's amazing. I don't know in any other situation where you could sell a festival and almost sell it out without even announcing who's going to be there, right? There's that much trust that it's going to be a great time. There's going to be big bands. So on the music side, Mike Heideman, so what did you think? A lot of big-time artists here.
A lot of great, great artists. You're exactly right. And this is actually one of the first years that they didn't sell it out, which was surprising. The festival had some of the greatest headliners on. We're talking Casey Musgraves, The Strokes, Ariana Grande, J Balvin, who ended up being one of the first Spanish-speaking headliners of all time here at Lollapalooza. So there was a lot of different cultures and people, and it was a very, very eclectic festival. But at the same time, you know, there's been years past when we see Metallica and Paul McCartney, huge, huge, enormous names, come to the festival when people are coming out in droves. Ariana Grande performed tonight, the closing night, And even though the crowd was massive, I think nearly half of the people who were in attendance showed up and were right at that stage. But it was a little bit smaller than the crowd that you saw maybe at Chance the Rapper's homecoming, which was, I think, either last year or the year before, which looked like the entire city had come out to support him. So even though it is Chicago's mainstay festival, maybe the city of Chicago is getting a little bit oversaturated, a little bit worn out of these festivals. I mean, Pitchfork, Namby at the Beach, Riot Fest, you know, it's a lot to take in nowadays.
Yeah, it's every weekend, it seems like, too, Mike. It's,
right?
You know, you look up and, hey, where's all the people at? Oh, here they are. They're over here in this park, and they're over here. It's, you know, it's kind of, you need a, almost need a scorecard to keep track of all the stuff's going on.
Oh, you're telling me. Just imagine walking through them all day in 80-degree weather.
Yeah, about it.
Or pushing 90. I wanted to get your thoughts on this. You know, it's a fan favorite. People get out there, and they look forward to it, and they come and see it from the band perspective, and you get a chance to talk to a lot of the different artists over time. I remember, so 21 Pilots was one of the headliners, and they have had a meteoric rise over the last handful of years. I saw them playing, might have been Sunday afternoon at 1 in the afternoon, you know, like maybe 3 or 4 years ago or something, and it was a great concert for them. They seemed super excited to be there. Is there that thought process on the band side that the, you know, for those that come here on a, you know, like the Chainsmokers or something, where they come in multiple times, and you can kind of see the crowd size as their career grows, so does the crowd, where the artists really enjoy and look forward to coming here as much as the fans?
Yeah, I mean, that has to be the case. You're sitting there and you're playing on the side stage when you're, and no one's coming out to you. And then all of a sudden you have one song released and all of a sudden you're playing the headlining stage. And 21 Pilots, wow, the heart of Columbus, they are like one of the biggest bands coming out of Ohio. To see them take the stage and just rock it was a really amazing thing. But look at Casey Musgraves. I mean, a small country singer that came out and then blew up seemingly overnight after her album of the year win this year at the Grammys, and now playing the headlining stage. Bands like the Chainsmokers, who yes, play Perry stage many years in a row to a small audience, and now one of the biggest EDM bands there is. But I like seeing bands that are up and coming. I spoke to the band Judah and the Lion, which is an amazing band from Nashville, Tennessee, who are just three guys who just wanted to create great music. They played a side stage, but here's a band that, even though here at Lollapalooza is playing the side stage, side stages during the day, sold out two nights at the Ryman Theater in Nashville. So it's cool to see these bands grow. And I mean, who knows what the next bands are going to be? Like, there were a lot of great up-and-coming bands that I saw. I mean, Tierra Whack, one of this amazing rap artist who was performing. There's other bands like Rich the Kid, who's coming up. Dean Lewis from Australia is an amazing folk singer. And there's Gary Clark Jr., who is he's always on the rise. One of the greatest guitar players of today. Closed out with a great Beatles song. He's going to be all over the place soon. And Sharon Van Etten played today, too. So we'll see who the next big sleeper hit is for the next few years.
Well, so what do you think? Before we go to news, and then we're going to come back, we're going to talk a little bit about your interview with Cameron Crowe and also your thoughts, additional thoughts on Lollapalooza. But what's kind of the secret sauce here that makes it work? C3 is the group that runs it, based out of Austin. I know you do a lot of stuff with South by Southwest. And mm-hmm. So what is it about what they do that makes this kind of, is it just the size, the enormity of it all that makes it all kind of work so well?
Yeah, oh, the size definitely helps, and they do a lot of great work over at C3. The office is, Lollapalooza is their main go-to event, and when I spoke to the people over at C3 when I was down in Austin, went to their offices, and they said, yes, you know, we put a lot of time and focus into creating this festival. It's something that is worthwhile for the people. Obviously, Lollapalooza was created by Perry Farrell, and he's kind of taken it upon himself to really market this festival to young people who are growing up. So you and I, we were into the rock bands. You know, we love seeing great, great classic music. But at the same time, now we look at Lollapalooza, and I don't know about you, but I don't know 95% of the bands that are playing.
Well, there's 200 bands. I mean,
I looked at the list. It's amazing how many bands are. You can't even fit them on one page. There's so many of them.
Right, and then some of the times I'm like reading them, I'm like, is this one band or is this like three people? And like, I can't decipher. Is this like hieroglyphics that I'm reading?
Well, you know, Hobo Johnson and the Lovemakers. I mean, that's, I never heard of them, but maybe you want to go see them when you get a minute.
Is that a real band?
It says it right here. Hobo Johnson and the Lovemakers.
I want to see it. It sounds enticing. All right. Well, here's the thing. We're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna come back. We're gonna send it to news. We'll have more with Mike Heidemann with his hand on the pulse of Lollapalooza. So stay tuned for that quick break. We'll be right back. 720 WGN. Easy listening. 720 WGN here, Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane in for Nick D until 5 a.m. Dino Tiberi to my right, Tom Hush in the booth. And on the line with us, a guy who has had his hand on the pulse of everything Lollapalooza is our one and only Michael Heidemann. So, Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back. Hey, I love that Tame Impala music bump in there. One of my favorite bands and a really great highlight at this year's festival as well.
Yeah,
shout out Tom.
I knew there had to be some method to the madness right there. So, and also 312-981-7200, your most, well, either your favorite toy, like a Stretch Armstrong. And we had some people from the 724 also did a, well, found out what was inside. They did it just by the normal kind of everyday torture method of stretching until he could stretch no more.
and then he broke apart.
Yep. And then on the dangerous toy side, a little bit of modification from the 773. They would have those bow and arrow sets with the suction cups. And you just take the suction cups off and shoot blunt sticks at your
friends.
Shoot
them up in a crowd and then watch everyone scatter and see who gets hit.
Yeah, from the danger side. So, Mike, here's the thing, too, is you cover not only the music side of things, and you talk to a lot of the different bands, and is there something that you could think, before we get into some of the movies and Cameron Crowe, and we'll have Blake coming on it, too, are there things that you would suggest as a guy who's covered so much of it that Lollapalooza could do, should do? We had a listener suggest that they should make some free tickets available, maybe as an incentive for students who do really well, or I can't read it from here, but maybe somebody maybe who did a good job on work release, right?
Turning their life around. Perfect attendance.
Yeah, perfect attendance. Yeah,
good grades.
I mean, are there overall
good citizen.
Are there things they can build into it so the headlines are, you know, aren't just like, hey, you know, people storming the gates,
jumping
going
over
to the
fences.
Hospital. Yeah, stuff like that.
No, there is a great, great community aspect to Lollapalooza, and that's why it's such a Chicago staple, and that's why people flock to it. In fact, if you volunteer for the festival, you get in for free. So if you're there to help out and create some buzz about it and just do some good work for your community, they do give you a free ticket. There's also the Music Cares program from the Grammys that provides free tickets and some support for people who would want to look into Lollapalooza as well. But I agree with you. Maybe some accelerated reader program would be an amazing touch to get people more involved with Lollapalooza. But at the same time, I mean, if you're doing really well for your community and you're going to Lollapalooza, the crowd kind of picks itself. So if there's a band you really want to see, maybe there could be, you know, an aspect of doing well in school or you know, putting in some volunteer service. But at the same time, you're going to be going there putting on glitter and dancing to your favorite band. So
if you could spell Lollapalooza, you get a free shot at a lottery ticket.
I like it, though, to build in the higher purpose to it. You know, and Mike, I'd nominate you. I'd stuff the suggestion box for the Minister of Access for it. You know, you can go ahead and kind of be a part of that.
Yeah, I'm gonna text Lori Lightfoot after this interview and then see if she wants to jump in on this too.
Yeah. Okay. So now here's the other thing, and I know that that Tom had mentioned it. So you got an opportunity to interview Cameron Crowe, you know, who has been part of some of our favorite movies and of course all that stuff with Rolling Stone. So tell us a little bit about it. I know you wanted to share that with the listeners as well.
Absolutely. That was one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done. You know, I'm a big music guy. I love speaking about it, and getting the chance to talk to Cameron Crowe was one of the most amazing highlights of my life. In fact, when I approached the interview, he's putting out a new documentary called David Crosby, Remember My Name, about the legendary musician David Crosby. And I had approached them saying, hey, can I get David Crosby? Not even thinking that Cameron Crowe would be an option. But they're like, and they said, sorry, we can't get you David. You know, he's kind of busy. Can we get you Cameron? And I'm like, what? I like fell back in my seat because as everybody knows, or as most people know, that's one of the biggest music fans, music lovers of all time. The guy is the youngest journalist ever for the Rolling Stones, the magazine. So to, did I say the Rolling Stones? Rolling Stone magazine. It's late. But he's an amazing music journalist. He still listens to great music. And, I mean, writing Almost Famous, it was a total pleasure to speak to him. Totally cool.
So how did you do it? Because, right, there's you only have so much time, however much time that you may have with him, but you could do an entire interview or two or three just on the directing and on the movie side of things, and, of course, on the music side. How did you decide what to do?
That's interesting you bring that up, because that's what I was going with throughout the day. I was like, how do I even speak to him? Because I have so many questions for him, and I just want to ask all music-based questions or movie. I don't know which approach I should take, but the interview lent itself to the movie that he was putting out, because David Crosby is such an interesting character. So we were able to talk about the connection of his movies with these interesting characters that he has created. I mean, Spicoli, you know, the actor in Almost Famous, who ended up, you know, it was just basically a self biography, basically, of his life. So leading it towards that and kind of wrapping around back into music was pretty cool. So the main things that I really wanted to ask him, though, to answer your question, were, how did you get these interviews when you were so young? What music inspired you, and what's your strategy to kind of let these musicians guard down? Because he speaks to such legendary rock stars like David Crosby, you know, Mick Jagger, all these great names. How do you get them to trust you and bring you on tour? So the interview kind of surrounded those kind of questions.
Oh, the experience had to be great. And then you look on the movie side of it, he's always kind of woven some just iconic soundtracks and music into those great stories as well. And so what a cool interview. And so where can people, do you have it up yet? Is it available at WGNradio.com for people to listen to?
Yeah, you can find it on WGNradio.com. You can just search Michael Heideman or Sound Sessions on the site. And you can also find it anywhere you find your favorite podcasts on iTunes as well. Just search Sound Sessions. And it was a total pleasure. And hearing that Tom Hush, one of the greatest minds in movies, was a fan of this interview, that was another highlight of my life.
You know, here, last question, very last question, other than where we can find, of course, WGNradio.com for Sound Sessions, all the different things that you do when bands come in, Mike Heideman talks to them, but also just I think the commitment of a Tom Hush. He said if there was a band that he really liked and appreciated, let's say ZZ Top, right, and he was going to be the tribute guy, he would grow the beard or do whatever he could to physically resemble the artist that he admired. And so, Mike, which artist would you do that for? Let's say you had the ability to sound or play like anyone and you had a band that you like, which artist would you most like to physically transform into?
Physically embody any music artist of the last 1,000 years?
Yeah. And then perform as a tribute artist for them.
Yeah. Two-pronged attack there, Mike.
That is a great, great question. Well, it'd have to be like a solo artist, because I'd want all the attention on me. So let's think here. How about... Sounds like Ray Charles.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, that's a serious commitment. Just based on what I'm in my mind, I'm seeing you, Mike Heideman, and I'm also seeing Ray Charles, and that's quite a transformation.
Yeah.
Well, that amazing voice of his, like, I've been really into just unique voices lately, and just having the, just going, sweet honey, oh, it would be amazing. And, you know, Jamie Foxx could later play me in a movie. It'd be really fun.
Have you ever done any Ray Charles when you're performing music?
Oh, you mean when I'm performing every single Saturday at Bill's Bar and Burger on 30 East Hubbard Street and Hubbard and Safeway by the House of Blues?
Now we're talking.
Not lately, but I should incorporate a lot more blues into there. I think that'd be a lot of fun for the audience.
I think after this segment, that's what people are going to be asking for. The crowd's going to be clamoring.
Yeah, that's right. They're going to want to hear Sue
Georgia
Brown.
We're going to let you get some rest, and we'll hear you, I'm sure, on the Cochran Show in just a handful of hours. And can't thank you enough for everything that you're doing, not only going and sharing Lollapalooza and, of course, sharing it with the listener here on the show tonight.
Dane, Dino, Tom, it was great talking to you. One of my favorite shows. I hope to talk to you again soon.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, so there you go. Reach out. No, that's ambitious, but that's what you expect out of a Michael Heideman. Yeah. You know, he's not going to just go easy.
He doesn't have a short catalog either. He goes all over the place. So
I think about this too: is the endorsement deals. Remember, he did those famous like Pepsi commercials or something. You got the right one, baby.
Yeah, that's right. That could be right up his alley. Yeah. More money in the coffers of a Mike Heideman.
That's right. So now, We're going to get a 312-981-7200, your favorite action hero of all time. We talked with Carl and Lisa a little bit about that. First, Carl decided his favorite action heroes was certainly a man of action, also a man of steel. Superman was the one that so we had to make that distinction that those were superheroes, right?
Yeah, not just your action hero.
Yeah, usually your action hero, if you want to describe him, he's oftentimes shirtless or wearing a tank top, maybe spent some time in the special forces. Maybe works out, maybe doesn't, or maybe has some kind of special skill. He's great at making bombs. I don't know what he does, but
yeah.
Do you know your thoughts? Favorite
I got to go back to Sylvester Stallone for me.
Really?
Rambo.
So, okay, Rambo.
Yeah, I mean, that was an action guy.
Special forces guy, right? Yeah. He's fitting in here. He had worked out.
Yep. He ran around without a shirt on.
And he's...
He didn't have much to say in the first movie, but...
And I think part of it, too, is your true action heroes are just themselves. So Sylvester Stallone, he doesn't really stretch far beyond Sylvester Stallone.
Right.
You know, you don't often see him... It's not like Meryl Streep, right, where she becomes the character.
Right.
He becomes Sylvester Stallone in just maybe a different, different outfit.
Sure.
Or a headband, bandana. Hush, your favorite action hero of all time, and you don't have to...
All time.
You don't have to narrow yourself to one. Maybe if you got two, three that you appreciate.
I'm going to say definitely Charles Bronson, because Death Wish is just a ridiculous movie, and that includes all the sequels, which are just insane. So,
and Charles Bronson is kind of like more quiet, more brooding. Like, there's a lot going on up in that Charles Bronson head.
Yeah, there is.
Whereas as Sylvester Stallone, maybe not a lot going on up there.
Hey,
just
man,
kill
listen.
The next guy in front of you. That makes it easy.
I'm going to say is that First Blood might be one of the most important statements about post-Vietnam America that was ever put to film.
Yeah. I love that movie.
It's a deep movie. It's sad, really, at its core. It's a tragedy about a vet who comes home and doesn't know who he is anymore, and a society that doesn't really know what to do with him. I think that's a really interesting.
It was a common tale, with a lot of those people that came back from Vietnam. So it was good. I enjoyed that movie a lot.
It was really good. I'm not saying that it's not good. It was he's really good, but. But isn't there a First Blood, like Last Blood or something coming out?
Yeah, so here's the deal. You got First Blood. You've got Rambo First Blood Part 2. Rambo 3. Rambo, just Rambo. That's the fourth one. And then this year, in about November, you're going to get Rambo Last Blood. So Rambo Part 5, Last Blood. And I believe he's taking on the cartels.
Whoa.
There'll be one drop of blood at the end.
Is it going to be last blood?
Open the door for another one.
Along the lines of, let's say, in a Cher context, where Cher does her like her retirement farewell tour, but she's on like her 11th retirement farewell tour.
I don't know. I mean, Sly is doing... He's well on in his journey through life. He's done so much. He's changed
the
face.
He's given so much.
He's given so much. And... you could see it as like, yeah, he's probably reaching the end of his career here, but he's still doing some of his best work. Like his turn as Rocky in Creed is incredible. Who thought that he could revive that character and continue giving it depth after we went through, six movies of the main Rocky series?
Yeah.
Who thought that he could bring it back and give it a whole new dimension?
And he got well-deserved acclaim for that, for all of that.
Absolutely.
Even though he's basically still himself.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not really super stretching, but he was really good in those movies.
Oh, he's excellent. I really think that he made a human... He made Rocky just a man. That's all he ever was. Rocky was just a man trying to fight for a better life for himself, and then each movie kind of deals with different aspects of that. Meanwhile, you've got some of the best villains in any movie series. Clubber Lang
was good.
Ivan Dragov.
Oh.
That's great stuff.
There is no tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's iconic lines in all those movies. It was like
the best Rocky quotes of all time. Best Sylvester Stallone quotes of all time, 312-981-7200. So people are adding in, of course, when we talk with Blake, he'll have a list. We'll have a list as well in true Nick D style. And so some of them from 301, favorite action hero, John McClane from Die Hard, of course, played by Bruce Willis. Now, Bruce... I don't know, in that, was he a special forces guy? Because we're saying, like, here's sort of your
criteria. No, he's a cop. Yep.
Okay, so he's a police officer, right? He wasn't necessarily, he did have the tank top, right? He had the
which gives you superpowers. Everybody knows that.
That's right.
And then, but he was like really smart and kind of like was able to like had some zingers and one liners. If you can do that, that is also just as powerful as if you had worked out.
Yeah, you've got to have that. You know, be able to drop that line in there right when at the perfect time. And you know, he had the same one in every one of his movies at the end.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, that's one that you always look for at the end of the movie.
Somebody we're gonna be talking about is a present day movie, and I think has assumed the mantle of really our resident action hero on the big screen today from the 773. Too bad The Rock does not count as an action hero. I think he does. He's 100%
action. He's in the Fast and the Furious movies, just literally kicking people down left and right. He's an action hero.
Skyscraper, right?
Skyscraper, Rampage. Remake of Walking Tall.
Yeah. So, Fear Not 773, he is an action hero. But also, too, he's so great looking, though. Yum, yum.
Well,
I think that's right. Part of it, too. You got to have a little bit of appeal on that side.
Yeah, the guy, he's in everything. He's in Ballers. That's an HBO series where he's a sports agent and just...
We still have our 45 break to go, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, so we're going to take that right now. When we come back, we're going to go through some of the lists. We're going to read some of your texts, whether it's your dangerous toys, your favorite toys, or your favorite action hero. 312-981-7200. It's Dane, and for Nick, 720 WGN.
Nice.
720 WGN. Hi, yeah. Tom Chicago in the Allstate Skyline Studio playing the hits. Tom Hush in the booth with a great bumper music. Dane in for Nick D until 5 a.m. Dino Tiberi to my right, riding shotgun from the 724. Rumor has it that Arnold was going to bequeath the Terminator franchise to The Rock. So in the latest Rock news. Also, The Rock was going to play Submariner at one point. Well, see, those are always kind of those fun things, like the people who gave up the role. You know, the people who didn't play, you know, Indiana Jones, right? There was somebody that was supposed to get it. I don't know, Clint Eastwood or something. Right. And then
somebody probably passed on it, too.
And then you can't imagine how it would be any different, right?
So. I mean, there's a whole two-hour conversation you can have about casting what-ifs, like, if this...
And would they even have become those iconic films without some of those actors that ended up taking those roles? We were talking a little bit about Cameron Crowe off the air, and Dino was going through some of the movies, and Singles was one of the ones that mentioned. I said, well, what's your favorite line from Singles? And this is one I still use on the kids today. Do you remember that movie, Singles?
Well, I've seen it, yeah.
Okay.
Been a little while for
me. It's been a long time ago.
1992.
It's like, isn't there a line of like, welcome to Debbie Country? Yeah, it's kind of like you come up. It's not important. Anyway, so here we go for it. Just so you know. 312-981-7200. Your favorite action heroes out there. It could be your favorite action movie. Could be an ensemble cast. You know, you mentioned A-Team, you know, where you had a bunch of different heroes in there. Okay, so here we go from the 807. I'm not sure where that's from, but hi, what about Weird Al as Conan the Librarian?
Conan the Librarian.
That's funny.
That goofy movie UHS. That was...
Yeah, that's... I want to say that's 30 or 35 years old this year. I can't remember which.
Yeah, that's an old one. That was right when Weird Al was just starting out.
So sometimes you become an action hero because you're in a special action role. We mentioned a little bit about the Terminator, right? I think once you take that role, you become an action hero. And so these are in alphabetical order, the 40 greatest action stars of all time. Number one, in no order other than alphabetical. This isn't in order of importance or prominence or anything. Antonio Banderas. Antonio Banderas.
Of course.
Right? And so he was, and I know, you know, you're thinking as Puss in Boots, right? Which is...
yeah, that was the one that jumped right in there. Sorry, I couldn't hold that one back.
But it's actually, because remember, he was Zorro, right? So I think once you take that role as Zorro, you're either doing late night infomercials about how to play a guitar, or you're an action hero.
Well, and especially he did a trilogy with Robert Rodriguez, which is El Mariachi, Desperado, and Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, those three where he plays the same... He's kind of like a nameless gunman, kind of like Clint Eastwood in the spaghetti westerns. But he's in all three of them playing the same character, and it's some of the best action movies you can watch from like the early 90s, early to... mid, and then I think Once Upon a Time in Mexico was like 2004 or 2005.
Yeah, that's a little bit more recent.
But Johnny Depp in there with an awesome action line. you're either a Mexican or a Mexicana.
We use that one.
Oh, boy.
We use that one at home, too, sometimes. And then Charles Bronson, of course, got mentioned. He's a tough guy personified, and he really was, right? Whether playing a cop, cowboy, or a soldier, Bronson, who's a U.S. Army veteran, thrived mostly in supporting roles until the Death Wish films began in the mid-70s, and that was when he was in his 50s. So he, you know, so you don't have to be, just like Sylvester Stallone. We're going to talk about Last Blood. Sylvester Stallone's every bit of, like, 75 years old or something like that, right? And he's still an intimidating and dangerous force, right? And then Nicolas Cage. So this guy, now Nick Cage gets a lot of flack for taking every single role.
One of the great American actors.
And one of the great roller coaster rides any actor's had.
I'm just saying, they say he'll take any kind of job, and good thing we mentioned Clubber Lang, the 1-800-COLLECT commercials. I pity the fool can't remember that. So he's not doing that yet, but he does take a lot of different roles. But I think he's good, you know, in those, like, National Treasures, or this action. I don't know if he's an action hero, but...
Well, I mean, you could bring up stuff like Gone in 60 Seconds, Con Air, which is a cable favorite. Like, if Con Air is on TV,
you're going to watch a little bit
of Con Air.
Because the Elvises.
And we sometimes forget that he's an Academy Award-winning actor. He won Best Actor for Leaving Las Vegas.
Not
a lot of action in that. A lot more depression and drinking.
Depravity,
But he's had a recent renaissance with these kind of culty movies. Like, he was in one called Mom and Dad, where this weird sort of signal goes out and it causes parents to start killing their own children.
Yeah.
He had one called Mandy, which was directed by Panos Cosmatos,
who was a Barry Manilow biopic.
Yeah.
But he was on the soundtrack.
But he fights like a Charles Manson ex-cult. Nope. Like, he goes crazy. So he's still doing it. He's still Nick Cage, just going absolutely bonkers.
Well, he's, you know, it's a long way from Valley Girl, I can say that.
or like Raising Arizona. He was awesome. That is a classic.
Man, absolutely.
So funny.
You know, Les Round is funny. So many great lines from those movies. All right, so... So Jackie Chan is in there, and I mean, when it comes to action, he's definitely doing the action thing, still active to this day, Jackie Chan.
Yeah, and I think he's may own the distinction of having broken the most number of bones on screen. That guy, especially if you go back to his early stuff from like the 70s and early 80s, like
before CGI.
Yeah, before CGI. But no, he was doing. Have either of you ever seen Police Story?
Well, the TV show.
Well, the Police Story was it was a Hong Kong action flick that he did, that he directed himself, and it started this thing where after during the credits sequence, it would show him doing the stunts and getting hurt.
Oh,
so that you could understand how much of this he was doing himself and how much danger and work, you know, was put into this just to make him one of the greatest living martial artists.
If you see any of the documentaries about him and what he in his preparation for things and just how he approached those roles, just physically, I mean, just what he was doing is amazing. And like take after take after take, and like I said, sometimes you break things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's you. Right. Unfortunately, Daniel Craig is in there as one of the better actors to take on the
James
role of
Bond.
One of those kind of more quiet, kind of subtle, gives you that sort of disapproving, I'm about to kill you stare. You know, he's got
and
that
then
thing
kills
down.
You, yeah.
And then he kills you. He also noted for his high impact work, the underrated Defiance in 2008, Cowboys and Aliens, which I liked quite a bit. I thought that was, you didn't like that, Cowboys and Aliens?
Not particularly. It's not one of, it's not one of my favorite.
You're on your own
favorite
on that one,
movies,
pal.
Man.
Right. I did say Debbie Country. All right, then Russell Crowe. Oh, so no, Russell Crowe. Okay. So this is a guy who's, you know, he has, and this is where I think the departure from on the range side from a Sylvester Stallone. So Russell Crowe can do also, he's a great actor, right? But also he can be the action hero. Gladiator, one of my all-time favorite movies. You hated that one too, huh?
Hate is a strong word. I didn't like it. I don't think it's one of Ridley Scott's best.
All right. Well, if you're not entertained, hopefully blockbuster Blake Stubbs is going to be joining us right after the news, and we're going to get a chance to talk with him. Quick break. We're going to come back, send it to news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. I love it. Hollywood. 720 WGN, Hyatt Top Chicago, Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick D. We do have Dino Tiberi in studio with us. Tom Hush is in the booth and on the line with us, has his hand on the pulse of everything when it comes to the movie world, the cinematic experiences through history, right? He has it all. So we're going to talk some current events, too, but also get his thoughts on some of the greatest action heroes of all time. We mentioned Antonio Banderas as Puss in Boots. It was very...
Somehow I don't think that's one that's on the old action list, but maybe I'm a little offline there.
He jumps. Granted, they're animated moves, but he's pretty nimble, I think. Blake, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How's it going? I love that you brought up action stars, and then you wanted to have me on the show because, you know, I'm always game to talk about this. Well, this is always one of my favorites.
I thought you were going to imply that you are, you know, when it comes to movie commentating, that you're an action hero of movie commentating.
Oh, in my own mind, yes. 100%. Absolutely.
Of course he is. He's Blockbuster Blake Stubbs.
Blockbuster. So where do you come down on Sylvester Stallone? We talked a little bit about the accolades that he's got, well-deserved for the role in Creed, but also, too, Sylvester Stallone in true movie star form and as an action hero, it's not always easy, right, to maintain, you know, as you get older, and like I said, pushing well into I think, the 70s now, you know, where he doesn't, mm-hmm. he doesn't stretch. Even in his most stretchy roles, he's still Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, I would put him pretty high on a list of American action stars, namely because he's got franchise characters that he's very well known for. And he's also had sort of a run of good waves in terms of decades about how he's perceived by the public. I mean, yeah, he's done a few things that everybody kind of looks at and they're like, really? For example, Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. That's one that I think a lot of, including Sly, might want to forget in some regard. However,
or Over the Top. You know, remember Over the Top?
Over the Top. Well, Over the Top is probably one of those premier 80s films that he did. But you've also got, I mean, think about it. Rambo and Rocky. Those are two very big characters. Those are action film-oriented characters. Rocky's more on the drama, the underdog story. Rambo is the grizzled war veteran who's dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. His films get a little more bananas as they go on in terms of what's going on. But, I mean, Rambo First Blood is actually a very enjoyable film, I think. I think it is one of those movies that's well made. I think it's the type of film that, like, right now, I think you could watch it and it still holds up. I recently saw it in theaters as recent as, I think, about within the last 10 years, and I thought, wow, this movie looks great on a big screen. You know, compared to a lot of the other action movies that sometimes just get churned out, I think that's one of those situations, and maybe Stallone is guilty of that as well with the Expendables franchise, mm-hmm. if you think about it. I mean, the first Expendables film was really interesting because it got all of these big names, and nostalgia was really high on it, but now I think we're going to have a fourth one come out pretty soon, as well as another Rambo film. So Sly's not stopping anytime soon.
Instead of Expendables, it was called Expiredables.
Yeah. Some of them might not be around for the next one, when you never know.
Well, here's the thing,
I would put him high on a list of action stars for that alone. I think his staying power, but also his franchise characters. So I think that's a big.
And I think he's got a great. You mentioned his kind of relationship with the fan base or with the public, or and people love him. He seems like a genuinely nice guy. He seems and some of these embodying these beloved characters. So he has, I think, the license where people just accept that it's Sylvester Stallone, even in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, where he's like, hey, yo, Yondo.
Yeah. You
know, he's still Rocky / Rambo, but in space.
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations where just about any comedian worth their salt will have an impression of both Christopher Walken, I think that's expected, but also a Sly Stallone. And I think that it's because there's an iconic sound that comes with, you know, the name Sylvester Stallone. You know, for some, I mean, I love having this conversation specifically about Stallone because I think he's a fine actor. When he really wants to be an actor, when he wants to be an action star, he gets to be an action star. And there was a very, to illustrate my point, there was a clip I remember watching, and I forget what it was for. It wasn't so much an infomercial. It was more like a commercial before a movie or something that wasn't a trailer, but they put Sly Stallone, the actor, the man, next to, and he just did like a split screen situation where he was also Rocky. And you could get a sense of, like, how much goes into playing the character of Rocky. Now, what you think of the Rocky films doesn't doesn't factor into this argument, I think. It's a matter of his mannerisms, the way he talks, the way he moves himself and acts and looks at the in the camera in some cases, and in this particular like trailer or commercial, I guess. But it's just, it's one of those things where he picks certain projects, and I think he's just the perfect pick for them. For example, if you could tell me that there was somebody that in the, you know, the American lexicon of action stars that was a better fit for John Spartan and Demolition Man, I'm all ears. But I don't think anybody could touch Sly. I think Demolition Man was his property with Wesley Snipes, and that is always going to be like the perfect role for him. Now, when it comes down to other roles, for example, you know, Copland, yeah, you might have been able to cast somebody differently. But right. Keep in mind, he had bankability. So that's the other thing. He's a bankable name, or at least, you know, has had waves where he's been a bankable name. So, yes, Sly Stallone's high on my list. He'll always be a high on my list action star, for sure.
It was in the last segment before we had you on. We talked a little bit about Jackie Chan and some of his, like, physical commitment to the action genre. And so if you've got some thoughts on that, for sure. But then also, I think, and we've talked at length about Tom Cruise in general, who really is, I think, a really talented actor and has done a bunch of different roles that really show, I think, his range.
Yes.
But when it comes to, you know, the bankability of being an action star, he loves it. He wants to be it, you know, the Mission Impossible thing. And when it comes to the stunts, like, he kind of demands to actually really do as many of them as he can.
Well, the first name you mentioned, Jackie Chan, I think should be on my personal Mount Rushmore of action stars, mainly because of his martial arts, you know, prowess, his ability to sort of also infuse comedy into everything that he does, the fact he does his own stunts. His stunt team is a world-renowned force when it comes to making action films. And plus, I mean, anybody that we list, I think he has either drawn inspiration from or has inspired them and has worked with. And I mean, look at all the names he has worked with. I mean, he's worked with the likes of Bruce Lee. He's worked with both internationally and domestically here in the United States. And most of his films make money. They do very well, especially overseas. I mean, he's a huge name internationally. And he's one of the names that it doesn't matter, you know, whether the film is made here in the U.S. or if it's made over in China or anywhere else. His name will bring people to the theater because we're always curious what it is he's going to do. And then just, you know, stacking on top of that, put Tom Cruise. You've heard me say it before, Dane. He's a bona fide movie star. And not just because he's a good-looking guy, not just because he's charismatic, but look at what he's been doing with the Mission Impossible franchise specifically. Every single film is one-upping the previous iteration. Whatever they're going to do on the next two films that he's making with Chris McQuarrie, I'm intrigued, and I will be there opening night. I saw Mission Impossible Fallout 3 times in theaters. That's a lot for me. Usually, I top out at 3 times when I see a movie during its theatrical run. But each time I found myself completely on the edge of my seat. I was trying to dissect how they pulled off all those stunts. And I like that that's his mindset when they get together to make a movie about characters that he cares about, you know, in a universe that he cares about. He wants people to go to movies and see something that they've never seen before. Now, that kind of goes hand in hand with the way Jackie Chan makes his movies, if you think about it. Jackie Chan just also has such a great world approach to how he makes his movies. You know, his approach to comedy is very much in the vein of like the Three Stooges, but somehow managing to bring that and blend it together with martial arts makes an infinitely entertaining man. And by the way, another guy that doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. And I think given the credibility of his stunt team, his legacy is going to go way beyond just the films that we've seen him in. He's going to have his hand in everything for as long as he wants to.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk some of your favorite action movies and action stars of all time. 312-981-7200. You can add yours as well. We've got some we're going to definitely mention from the listeners as well. We're going to talk to some obvious ones, right? And we're going to talk about The Rock, if he's assumed the mantle of kind of our current day resident action hero on the big screen today. And then some others that you don't necessarily think of, like Matt Damon. You don't necessarily think of him, but he's on the list here. So we'll talk about that, plus get Blake's picks as well. So keep it here. Quick break. It's Dane here on 720 WGN.
We'll be right back.
kind of like name that tune, right? I could name that tune in
12 notes.
Yeah, I needed more notes.
Need
more notes. 720 WGN live here, Allstate Skyline Studio until 5 a.m. In for Nick D. And we're talking the biggest, the best action movies of all time, best action heroes, 312-981-7200. You can add yours as well. And we have the authority on the line with us as well, Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, talking about some. And it's kind of a nuanced thing, right? Some are obviously action heroes. You think of the just, I think, the general scope of activity that they have, which is, you know, maybe blow up things, maybe some cool one-liners, maybe rescue some people, right? Or get into
or mix all those together.
Chase scenes.
Yep.
You know, Blake, do you have like a criteria in order to, you know, because we've got a list that says, and some of these aren't necessarily your usual suspects, no pun intended, but, you know, we're in order to fit into the category, to be a legitimate action star, is there a certain kind of criteria that you have?
Not entirely. I would say that it takes one really solid action film to qualify one as an action star. And I think that in that case, you know, I mean, there's some that the only thing one can associate, a star with is action films. But think about it. I mean, look at what the Alien films did for Sigourney Weaver. In my opinion, she's an action star just thanks to those films. One was a horror film. That was Alien. Aliens was more of an action film. But at the same time, at no point did you question, you know, how much of a bad to the bone character she was. And at the same time, it's also a woman in the action lead role. So, I mean, is she by and large known as an action star? No, but can she qualify as an action star in my book? Heck yes. And that's just because she had a particular character that resonated, as an action protagonist. And even in the more Alien horror film, because to me, Alien is more of a suspense thriller, horror, sci-fi film than Aliens, which is more of a, you know, James Cameron directed action film. I would argue that, you know, it doesn't take much when you look at the scope of one's entire career. Another example of this, just to illustrate my point, and again, when we talk action stars, I could probably just start talking about Asian actors and be here all night, because there's plenty to discuss just in that realm alone. But Chow Yun-fat is an actor that may be on your list, maybe not on your list. However, he made several films with John Woo that I think make him one of the all-time great action stars. Yet in China, he is known for playing romantic leads, comedic roles. He's known for playing everything. But to us in America, he's mostly just known as an action star. So I think the criteria for me has to be pretty loose in that regard. I think they just have to convince me enough that they're capable of leading an action franchise.
Yep, Chow Yun-fat is here, and of course, we all, in my mind, when I think of him, I think of him flying, like, over the hood of a car with two guns, like, firing at the same time. So, on the action side, definitely, and 100%. We also talked a little bit earlier, is that if you assume one of the traditional action hero roles, there was talk about The Rock maybe taking over for The Terminator. Yeah. We talked about Antonio Banderas, once he played Zorro, and of course, Puss in Boots, right? Then he was automatically an action hero. So, Matt Damon is a guy he's funny, he's a... You know, downside. I mean, he's a funny guy. He's a talented, obviously, an Oscar-winning, screenwriter. You know, and all the things that he does. I think he's a really good actor. But once he became Jason Bourne, here he is on the list. Matt Damon.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Matt Damon is a star who has sort of transcended whatever it was expected of him. You know, a good-looking young guy who's going to be romantic lead in this, or maybe a little bit comedic in that. And obviously, Good Will Hunting was a heck of a debut for a guy who, you know, really stepped forward into the public eye. But when you think about it, Jason Bourne is probably the easiest role to associate him with because of, you know, multiple films. But on top of that, the action in all of them is pretty good. I know that there's always been a lot of debate about how well those scenes were edited together, the shaky cam and all that stuff. But the tense nature of the action, I think, is inarguable in a lot of ways. I would also say that, he's diversified his sort of palette, and he's never really taken himself too seriously, except when he needed to. For example, you know, something like The Departed. Really good dramatic role for him. Also, he's a big part of the reason the suspense in that film works so well. But then you double back a little bit in his career, and you get, you know, independent spirit type films such as Jerry, which I believe was a Gus Van Sant film. And you've also got things like he worked with Kevin Smith and made a bunch of comedies. So he's one of those guys that I think has that diverse palette in terms of his overall arch, you know, as an actor. But yeah, you could easily sell Matt Damon as an action star to me just based on the fact that he did the Bourne films. There's Elysium. That's another one that was a sci-fi action film. And, you know, he's shown up in other things and been a convincing lead, not just in the action realm. So, yeah, Matt Damon for me is a pretty high, you know, more modern take. I mean, he's been able to diversify his overall acting palette. But at the same time, he's convincing when he needs to be in the action realm.
When we come back from the news, we are going to talk a little bit about The Rock, his kind of role in whether it's the Pantheon or on the totem pole of action heroes. And, of course, the current film that's out now that's part of that kind of franchise with the whole kind of Fast and Furious and Vin Diesel. And Vin Diesel is kind of a guy that I would put closer towards, but less of a big star than Sly Stallone, but sort of in that area, right? I think he's got his niche. He works well within his niche, but I don't know that I could see, you know, a romantic comedy with, or a successful one with a Vin Diesel. I mean, where do you put him in there? I mean, he got, I don't want to say lucky, but was fortunate to have a role that was really perfect for him early on, and he's just kind of kept going with it.
Yeah, I would put Diesel as a convincing action lead, or at least, you know, it would be hard to see him sell a romantic comedy to me. Now, granted, I always am willing to admit when I'm wrong, and if that's the route he wants to go, I think he is talented enough to sell that and make it work. But I think he, like you mentioned, there's a niche, and he found it, and he has made sure to ride that wave and know that, you know, hey, as long as audiences are going to keep paying for it, we're going to keep making them. But at the same time, I think he is very funny. I mean, look at what he's done with Groot and the Guardians of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
What do you mean, look what he's done? He doesn't done anything with it. It's an animated little tree stick guy, and the only thing he says is, I am Groot. That's it.
His voice, but also I know that they have captured his performance for that role as well. So it's not just that he said some stuff into a microphone. There's a bit more to it. It's just, I know that that's a little hard to
imagine,
to just kind of give him the, you know, the easy play on, you know, but I think that that sort of helps stick my argument, is that he's willing to kind of branch out and do other things. And at the same time, did you know that he actually does it language that they release the film in? I mean, granted, he only has one line.
Also, too, I think we cannot unnotice the, you said he is going to branch out, because I think there's a tree-related acting pun, right? There's no doubt, too, that Blake is working as Vin Diesel's representative on his next contract.
Getting a cut in the next
one, are you,
Blake?
There's no denying that he was amazing in this. I don't know, it's hard. We'll think about it during the break. When we come back, it's like Hobbs and Shaw, I think, is the movie where you've got where you've got The Rock in there. Another action film. Is it good? Is it not good? I don't know. I haven't got a chance to see it. The kids saw it. They loved it, right? You know, but he's so great in so many different things, because he is every bit. He's funny. He's, you know, somebody had described him as yum yum, so I'll be objective about it and say, you know, but so I think he works in a bunch of different ways that maybe Vin Diesel can't. And then I think he does have some range. Granted, I think physically it's tough, right? Because he's the Rock,
right?
Yeah. So he, you know, it's tough for him to kind of take on some roles, but
he played the Tooth Fairy. I mean, you know,
but he was still like the Rock with like wings glued on the back of him.
Of course.
So we'll talk about that in a second. Quick break, and we're going to come back. We're going to send it to news. It's Dane here, along with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. We're going to have more of him, Christino, and Tom as well. 720 WGN. WGN in for Nick DiGilio until 5 a.m. It is Dane here with you. I do have Dino Tiberi to my right riding shotgun, Tom Hush in the booth, and on the line with us from the recognized Hollywood of the Midwest, Peoria, Illinois, the one and only Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. And so when it comes to The Rock as an action hero, I think he's I like all of his different roles, whether it's as the animated characters in Moana, right, or as a comedy slash action in Jumanji, you know, or some of the, even Skyscraper, we all watch it. He's one of those few guys, and I don't think, you know, we're alone as a family, because Hobbs and Shaw finishes in first place with $60 million in its debut. So if I see Dwayne Johnson on the marquee, I'm going to duck in.
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head with The Rock. The thing about Dwayne The Rock Johnson is that he had the better part of a decade and almost a decade and a half of time to refine his charisma and get ready to be in front of the cameras in the pro wrestling world. That he grew up around the pro wrestling world. He became one of the hottest stars in the history of pro wrestling. His transition from that the world of sports entertainment into cinematic entertainment went really well, by and large. I mean, there were a couple of, you know, little stumbles early on, but by and large, he has been nothing but bank at the box office for the better part of a decade. In fact, I believe I looked this up because I remembered reading about it. He was the second highest paid actor last year, only second to George Clooney, whose money comes through a lot of business ventures and other things. But as far as like actually being on camera, The Rock is probably the second highest paid actor on the planet. He does exceptionally well. His name draws people to the theater. And look, it doesn't really matter what movie it is. I mean, it could be Skyscraper. It can be Rampage. I mean, these are just a couple of movies that came out in 2018. But they both did fine at the box office. And then you get something like The Fast and the Furious, where he plays, you know, one of the big characters who sort of joined as a supporting character and now is leading his own film in that franchise with Hobbs and Shaw. Yeah, I mean, and Jumanji, let's talk about Jumanji. Really entertaining films that are both, you know, not just made for adults. Those are family-oriented films as well, in some ways. So he's the kind of guy you can put in a movie, and his charisma and his look goes so far. And you mentioned Moana, which I thought he was outstanding in. So, yeah, no, The Rock's always going to be a winner. And I'm a wrestling fan, so I grew up watching him and saw that transition happen in real time. I mean, I was hoping that it would do well, but I didn't know it would do as well as it did. That's as a, you know, as a wrestling fan who wants to see, you know, one of your heroes succeed. So, yeah, The Rock is a big one, especially now, because I think he's going to start taking on roles that I think, if rumors are to be true and there's going to be a remake of Big Trouble in Little China, he's rumored to play Jack Burton, which was the Kurt Russell role from the original film. So, yeah, no, The Rock is a big name as far as action cinema goes these days.
You know, he just happened to, because, you know, based on his physique and opportunities and all the kind of things mm-hmm. that were going along with, and then his family background on the wrestling side. So that was kind of his avenue towards, I guess, the entertainment business. But I remember I got a chance to talk at the Daytona 500 with Hermie Sadler, who had a car dealership down in like North Carolina or whatever, and The Rock was doing, they had some sort of like the same manager or something, right? Some kind of connection where mm-hmm. The Rock was doing commercials for him. So you've got like this kind of, if we remember some of our, you know, not, they're not necessarily, well, I guess they probably were low budget, like your Solozzi Edelson kind of like commercials, you know, where it's kind of contrived and kind of goofy. And then there's The Rock, and he's every bit the same Rock, you know, with the eyebrow up and get, I can smell.
Oh, yeah.
I can smell what The Rock is cooking, which is great deals and low prices. You know? but you could even tell there, it was the same guy, that he really was transcendent in that world. He wasn't topping out as a wrestling personality. The potential was so much more.
You don't buy from with The Rock, you're going to get the people's elbow.
Well, I mean, you can go back and you can watch these.
I'd like to see that is on YouTube.
Yeah, they're on YouTube. Yeah, and he's doing, so it's like, hey, you know, our prices are already low. It's like, and right, he did all of those kind of moves, and the eyebrow goes up, and The Rock is cooking, you know, free Rusty Jones undercoating. It's hilarious.
He, you know what's so interesting about The Rock is that he actually, I guess just this week, announced that he is retiring from pro wrestling. Which is to say, don't expect me to come back and do another match. One, he doesn't need the money. Let's be real. The guy's making, you know, oodles of money as a movie star. But at the same time, he's one who never really lost it. He just left when the time was right for him to transition. And what he was able to do with that has led to great success. And knowing that, though, that, as you know, as Dino just pointed out, the people's elbow, the eyebrow raising, all of that stuff, he can still do it all. That's always going to be a big part of who he is as an entertainer. And I think that it says a lot that he's been able to actually build a movie career without really having to do any of that. Now, I'm not saying he hasn't done it in his films. I mean, I think one of the reasons why wrestling fans will love seeing him in films is that he'll give you that little flash of it every once in a while. But by and large, he's not building a movie career by being The Rock anymore. He is Dwayne Johnson, and that's who he wants to be known as, the actor, the movie star, the action star. And I think he's done a pretty good job of it. I mean, I think when I've reviewed films he's been in, I've given him a fair shake. I wasn't a big fan of Baywatch by any means.
Oh, yeah,
but
fair.
I did enjoy, for what it was, Rampage, which was one of the simplest like video game adaptations of a film that you could have. And in the end, he carried that movie and really made it work for me.
Anytime
so
you can see
I think
the you know, like a giant albino gorilla or like a 700
yeah.
foot alligator. I mean, it's pretty enticing, right?
Plus, it was right here in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the other hook to it. So
312-981-7200. As far as some of the action heroes people are adding in, you know, Steve McQueen from the 309. Then you've got the 815.
Yep.
Recognizing Vin Diesel's range. Vin Diesel, they think he did a movie called The Babysitter or something, and he was pretty funny in there. So maybe they wrote some jokes for Vin Diesel. And then from the 724, Hobbs and Shaw, awesome action movie, great chemistry, excellent cast. Spoiler, I won't do the spoiler. However, no direct references or cameos from FNF. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but
Fast and Furious.
Oh, gotcha. Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
Well, yeah.
So I got the code from the text. But so, and you look at the how it's done in the box office. Rotten Tomatoes is very favorable. I've seen some reviews that have been maybe less glowing. But what were your thoughts, Blake Stubbs?
Well, I have yet to get out and see this movie. This was supposed to be on my short list. I ended up seeing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for the third time today instead.
Yeah.
I couldn't stay away. And I will say, though, with regards to Hobbs and Shaw, I'm hoping that it sort of takes this franchise that, you know, people have watched for a very long time at this point, Fast and the Furious films, and takes it in a new direction. Now, obviously, trying to separate itself from the original cast, using two characters that started out as supporting roles. One was a villain, and the other was sort of an anti-hero good guy in The Rock's character, and see where they go. The other thing is they got Vanessa Kirby involved, and I'm a very big Vanessa Kirby fan. So, I mean, Idris Elba, you can't keep me away from watching movies with him. I think he's excellent. So, I mean, they've got all the ingredients for a movie I'm going to enjoy. This week I will get out to see it finally, but yeah, I mean, you pointed it out, Dane. I mean, box office is doing exceptionally well. And at the same time, Rotten Tomatoes is your metric, as I like to say. It's a favorable look for that film. Now, when you start dissecting things and what's good and what's bad, I mean, of course, you'll have your disagreements and the nitpicking and whatnot. But by and large, I mean, this movie looks big. It looks bold. It looks crazy. I'm interested. I just haven't had a chance to get out to see it. I had to go see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood one more time today.
When we come back from our next break, we're going to go deep into that. That has been, I think, a conversation starter in a bunch of different ways. Not only a huge hit, but a lot of people have been talking about it. I knew you got a chance to see it in multiple times and also in one of its best formats. So we're going to talk about that in a second. So but I want to get your thoughts. Liam Neeson really quick. And then, of course, Chuck Norris, who's incredibly tough.
Oh, yeah.
And when you have an entire genre of jokes built around Chuck Norris.
Yes.
And then also, too, from the 773, just added in, of course, John Wick. I think Keanu Reeves was already, from The Matrix, Tom had brought up he was in Point Break. I guess there was some action stuff going on there. But I think The Matrix, you know, made him an action star, and then the John Wick has solidified it for sure.
I would argue that is the exact case. He has done Point Break being one particular early action film in his career. I think that he had the presence. I certainly think he had the look. I will say, though, that if you ever want to, you know, try to get into an argument about whether Keanu Reeves is a talented man, he is. It's just a matter of his range has to be put to good use. And in the case of the John Wick franchise, not only was this built around him and, you know, written for him, essentially, and then directed by his former stunt double from the Matrix films, there's a chemistry there that helps keep these films so fresh and alive. And look, there is going to come a point where I'm sure they're not as fresh and alive as we thought, but honestly, as long as they keep making movies like they have and they keep growing and building, Keanu Reeves is probably going to be one of the top action stars in my book ever, strictly because of his commitment, I think, to the role of John Wick. And that's not to discount his work in the Matrix trilogy, nor is it to discount his work in Point Break. I think it's just in an era where we're we're trying to get so much more on screen and away from, you know, true action on camera. Keanu does a vast majority of his own stunts, with a few exceptions, as he's pointed out in many interviews throughout the time that the John Wick films have been coming out. But at the same time, he wants to keep these things fresh, cool, exciting, and he wants audiences to be on the edge of their seat. And if you did see John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum, which I did 3 times in theaters, because it is high on my list this year, the action in that movie is outstanding. And it just is. I mean, from start to finish, there's each one of the action sequences is almost like a musical number, and each musical number tries to be different from its predecessor as the film progresses. And there's good nods to other action stars, specifically guys from the Raid films, which are very high on my list as far as action films go. And I would just say that, yeah, Keanu's got to be top of the list, at least right now. And especially if, you know, you thought the Matrix movies were cool, but now you're seeing John Wick and being like, wait a minute, this guy is insane, the stuff he's doing on camera. Well, it's because they have an outstanding commitment to making sure those films are raising the bar every time they make one.
Some of the other people on the list I'll read before we go to break. Kurt Russell, of course, is one of your very favorites, and I think he's been in some great action movies. But we love like Overboard. Like, I think the kids watch that like every month. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, undeniable. And then this guy who's found a career in reality television, law enforcement, Steven Seagal, who I think we found has the least amount of range, maybe, right? Because he's still Steven Seagal, and even Steven Seagal is kind of, well, just Steven Seagal. What do you think?
He's got the tough guy presence is what it is. He's a big guy, and I'm not talking about, you know, in his earlier days, he was a much larger guy than he's gained weight, yes, but he's also aged. And I'm not gonna knock the man for that. Where I will say he worked, I think, on camera is that he could just stand there and say very little and be imposing. And if you want to make an action film and the guy looks the part, you're taking steps in the right direction. And that was always Steven Seagal. Now, conversely, you know, his nemesis on camera was Jean-Claude Van Damme, who is not the tallest guy, but was also a martial artist, and is a recognized martial artist from, I believe, the 70s. He was a kickboxer, but also he did, I believe, full contact martial arts, karate specifically. And, you know, all these guys have some kind of martial arts background, or it was a passion of theirs. And I think that the fact they were able to do all of these things on camera and look the part and look imposing, you know, puts them high on a lot of people's lists. But then, you know, look at a couple of the other the big names that we would mention here. You know, Tom Cruise, Stallone, Bruce Willis, Arnold, these guys aren't known for being martial artists. They're just known for having the look, the style, the charisma. I think it's just when you transcend, you know, the whole looking the part, and you can kind of be the part on camera, it works for audiences, especially if it's in the hands of good directors and cinematographers and stunt coordinators. For example, that's another reason why I'd backpedal a little bit and say Jackie Chan will always be high on everybody's list.
Yep.
Same with Jet Li, Bruce Lee. Like, I mean, you could just run down the list of Chinese action stars specifically and realize that they have a background more often than not in martial arts, but at the same time, they just have a look about them that works. And it's hard to say what that it factor is, but when you look at this list and all these names we're going through, I think you can find a lot of similarities between all of these actors that just makes it work for them.
Some similarities. There's a little bit of range that I think is available in there, too, and I think a specific skill set. And before we go to break and come back and talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tom, you have a little Steven Seagal moment for us?
I'm going to take you to the bank, Senator Trent. To the blood bank.
You got to write that stuff. Above the Law was I think good. I think that's what put him on the map, and then they spent the rest of his career trying to recapture that.
That was classic.
That magic. So Blake, hold tight. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the movie that America has seen. America's talking about. Blake has seen 3 times. Keep it here. 720 WGN. Uh, 720 WGN live here until 5 a.m. It is Dane in for Nick DiGilio and Dino Tiberi. Is to my right the prodigal nephew, right?
Larry from Aurora.
Larry from Aurora is Dino's Uncle Tom Hush is in the booth and on the line from the recognized Hollywood of the Midwest. We do have Blockbuster Blake Stubbs on with us. And Blake, off the air, we were talking a little bit about it, and we want to get into it, so it's only going to take 1 second, so don't feel the need to expound on Steven Seagal's reality television career as a law enforcement official. But had you seen the one where it's like the show Cops, except he's just, you know, whatever kind of random problem, you know, you pull someone, hey, do you realize your taillight is out? You know what I mean? That's like the whole show. Have you seen it?
I have seen clips of this. I have laughed at it, even though I probably shouldn't be. But I will say that if there's anything better in reality TV than that right now, I'm all ears, to be honest with you. I think that for me, I'm not a big reality TV viewer, okay? My idea of watching reality TV and enjoying it is watching reruns of Hogan Knows Best, okay? However, I will make an exception for Seagal as a deputy sheriff, I believe, and I think that maybe
sheriff. I'm Ron Burgundy.
I think question mark. I don't know. I've seen clips though of exactly the show you're talking about. It's Cops, except do you know how fast you were going back there, and then it's Steven Seagal, and you're like.
There's no
really not fast enough to escape this hellscape. So there you go.
Right, and there's no high speed like running chases through the backs of yards. There's no, and it's just one kind of random non crimes they happen to bump into that day. It's like your plate is expired. Right. Okay. So enough about that. One thing that is a reality is that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a phenomenon. Right. This is a big movie. Talk a little bit about number one your thoughts for it, and then of course you got a chance to see it in sort of its pristine form, right, in the 70mm, right?
I did, yes. So the Music Box Theater in Chicago, I believe until Thursday the 8th, so you only have a few days left, there's a chance to see it in 70mm. Now, why go see it in 70mm? Well, first of all, I will always be a proponent of seeing things projected on film. I get it. We live in an era where most theaters project things digitally. It's just the way things are. In a lot of ways, that's okay. It's fine. However, a lot of filmmakers still try to shoot on film. Quentin Tarantino is a writer-director who does do this. And this particular film, I thought, really looked excellent. I really enjoyed how this looked projected on 70mm. And the upside you have is that the 70mm print that you're going to see at the Music Box is only running for a limited engagement, but at the same time, it's a pristine print. It's one of those things where it was put together. There's only, I believe, 5 screens in the whole country that are projecting this in 70mm. The Music Box is one of them. You have a rare opportunity in Chicago to see a film the way it was intended to be projected. Granted, if it was just in 35, that'd be fine too. The film was shot, as I understand it, in a mixture of 8, 16, and 35mm film. But the high dynamic range, the color, there's so many things that I could expound upon as to why 70mm is worth your time. But if you do go see it at the Music Box, they have a short, it's almost like a trailer for 70mm, which answers the question of why 70mm. And they explain what makes it so special. So, you know, that's a good night out. But know that this film is quite long. It's 2 hours and 41 minutes. It's longer than a vast majority of other things you're going to see in theaters this year. But it's written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. It is his 9th film. He's supposed to quit after 10, and that's his words, not mine. But this is a film that is sort of chronicling a period of time in Hollywood in 1969 when the star of Sharon Tate is rising and her husband, director Roman Polanski, is also, his career is on the rise, while at the same time a character by the name of Rick Dalton and his stuntman Cliff Booth, which are played by Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, respectively, their star has been fading. There's stars that, DiCaprio's character's a star that didn't really make it out of the transition from the classic Hollywood era. And he's been trying to scrape together some sense of a career for a while, and he's starting to see that star fade, while simultaneously living next door to a couple whose star just seems to keep on rising. And I don't really want to give too much away, because I think that the trailers for this film really didn't give anything away, other than sort of take you into the world for a quick glimpse. I know that this film has been divisive. I know that people are have very strong opinions about it. I know that by and large it is a well-received film. Critically, it's doing very well. I think that audience-wise it's doing quite well. In fact, I think this was Tarantino's biggest opening box office-wise in his entire career.
Wow.
But I gotta let people know that this film is a love letter to Los Angeles, and I know that some are like, yawn, roll eyes, another one of these films. I didn't find this to be a nauseating love letter to L.A. And I know that some films have come out in the last few years and people are tired of seeing these films. However, know that this is a period film. This takes place, with a few exceptions of like clips and things that are shown, it takes place in 1969. And if you've driven through Los Angeles in the last few years, a lot of the buildings and places that they drive by are left unchanged from their state in 1969. And that kind of lends a little authenticity to this film. At the same time, you have excellent acting, wall to wall, in my opinion, from DiCaprio, from Pitt, from Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate, even down to, I would say, we were mentioning Steve McQueen earlier, Damian Lewis, has a small part playing Steve McQueen in this film, and he's one of my favorite parts of the film. There's nuance in this that I think it would take someone like a Tarantino to write it. And for me, the movie just worked. I mean, it has its problems. It's not perfect, but it's still one of the better films I've seen all year. And I think that, you know, by and large, encapsulating that period of time in Hollywood, it was transportative. I found myself transporting back to this time that existed before I was born. But at the same time, it really did sort of grasp what a lot of people think of when they think of Hollywood, which is, in truth, it's a very small town. It's a lot smaller town than you think it is. And I remember when I saw the trailer, that's what my prediction of what the film at a very broad stroke glance was going to be. I think he was going to make a movie about how small of a town Hollywood is. And in many ways he did.
Before we let you go and mention, this is the ninth movie from Tarantino. He said he's only going to make 10.
Yes.
People who love him love his movies, and they've got, you know, they've got a signature style about him. But of course, like you said, this is the most popular one. So it's maybe branching out to audiences that are beyond his normal scope of fandom or interest. Can you tell it's a Tarantino movie from the get-go? Does it seem like one?
Every bit a Tarantino movie from start to finish, yes. And that's, if you know someone who has never seen a Tarantino film, this would be an interesting one for them to watch. I think that they will probably comment that the movie's a bit long. Now, I can tell you, after having seen it three times, it doesn't feel as long. Today, I saw it with somebody who had not seen it yet, and his take on it was that he really enjoyed it. It was very much a Tarantino film, and he was laughing. And at the same time, he was having other reactions to scenes where he was like, wait a minute, I know, because this has historical context built into it. So I think that it's a rich viewing experience for people. If you are a Tarantino fan, from the camera movements to Red Apple Cigarettes, to the way certain scenes are edited, to the dialogue, the way it's all written and spoken, yes. This is a Tarantino film from beginning to end.
Wow, you heard it here. So much about your favorite action heroes and, of course, some of the biggest movies in the theater today. So, Blake, as we let you go, places, you know, online and social media where people can continue the conversation?
Oh, yeah, the best place. You got to find me on Twitter, at Blake Stubbs. I feel like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a movie people definitely need to discuss. They'll probably be discussing it probably more than most other films that come out this year. And I would highly suggest seeing it. And if you have questions or you want to chat about it, hit me up there, at Blake Stubbs, BLAKESTUBBS.
Blockbuster Blake, the best in the business. Thanks, Blake. Get some rest, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
See you, Blake.
All right, quick break. Then we're going to come back. We're going to send it to news, 720 WGN. WGN. Hi, atop Chicago in the Allstate Skyline studio, in until 5 a.m. in for the very fine Nick DiGilio, who just isn't in here, but we did have somebody call in or text in and asked if Nick was okay, and we believe that he is absolutely 100% fine. 312-981-7200. People are adding in their thoughts on their favorite action hero and action movies of all time. And we did talk with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. From the 724, didn't get a chance to ask him on the air, but I did text Blake this question. The question was all hyped to see Once Upon a Time, but then I heard about the Bruce Lee scenes. And there's a number of different scenes from Hollywood icons of the past in there, and now I'm afraid that these scenes will taint or ruin the whole enjoyment of the film for me. Thoughts? Question mark. Suggestions? Question mark. And Blake was nice enough to get back. He says, it's a fictional encounter that is both hilarious and silly. It will not taint the impression of Bruce Lee. And Mike Moe, the actor playing Lee, is perfect. So without reservations, head on in there and you can enjoy that movie. No one mentioned Harris Ford. Of course, we remember Burt Reinhardt Ford, 3535 right. North Ashland.
That's right, Lynn Burton.
815. And then someone had asked if Dane Cook was the host. Unfortunately, not.
Yeah, that's not.
It would be more expensive and probably some more jokes thrown in there.
Well,
depending on
whether
you like.
I don't think it would be as funny as you are, but that's all right. That's just me.
Aw, Dino. Well, when it comes to, you know, some actual real celebrities, you got to hang out with a lot of them tonight. You know, people that are either in town for this event or some of our favorite kind of sports stars from the Chicago world of sporting excellence, some actors, a bunch of people.
Yeah, there was this is the 8th annual Canal Shores Invitational golf outing that Bill Murray's youngest brother Joel puts together every year, along with Betsy Shepard, who's done a lot of publicist work over the years, working with Walter Payton, Mike Ditka, and others. And so, yeah, tonight was the pairings party over at Joe's on Weed Street, and so there was
a
lot.
Is this where people find out who their kind of celebrity member of their foursome
would
be?
Yeah, well, they say that it's a pairings party, but really it's just a, you know, they
party
do a
party?
Lot, yeah, party
I saw
party.
Some of the pictures.
Yeah, there's some fundraising going on. There's a live auction that went on. There was a number of things that went off. David Ross was there from the Cubs. They auctioned off one of his jerseys that he signed, and there was a painting that was a Chicago Bear painting that was done, and some other items that went up for the 20th annual Murray Brothers Caddyshack tournament down in Florida is coming up. So they had a bidding on that for a foursome, you know, for the whole thing, VIP deal down there. And that went off at about $7,000 for that. So,
wow.
But yeah, there was a lot of actors there, a lot of sports people. Jim McMahon was there, Kevin Butler was there. Kevin's son Drew also was in the NFL for a brief period of time. He was there. We'd had a whole bunch of people. George Wendt.
Wendt was there. Nice.
A lot of character actors you've seen over the years. Mike Starr, who's been we just saw him on TV a little while ago. I was pointing it out to you. He was in Goodfellas. He's been in a number of movies that people know. If they see his face, he's definitely.
Our very own Larry Wirt was there as well.
Larry Wirt was there. He was there with Kevin Butler hanging out, and he was making the rounds. And
Cato Kaelin?
Cato Kaelin was there. I got a picture with him and Larry.
Now, Cato, for those people who don't know, used to be, he was on the Bears as well. He was a backup punter. Or maybe he was O.J. Simpson's house guest. That's his football connection.
Yeah, it could be something along those lines. Bonnie Hunt was there. They even had the guy that he still continue his 15 minutes of fame. He was there.
He's in overtime.
He was there working his magic. Joel Murray was sporting the Cubs sport coat. He was doing all the handling all the live auction things. They had a bunch of silent auction items. Now the golf tournament's tomorrow.
Today,
I should say. What am I thinking? It's later this morning, as a matter of fact, that I'll be there working with the Harry Carey's restaurant group. This tournament's a little unique because there's all kinds of other things that go on. There's a dunk tank. There's somebody giving haircuts out on one of the holes. Last year, there was a mechanical bull.
So instead of just, you know.
Yeah, so when you're waiting for the group in front of you to go out, you know, you just have a little fun on the side while you're waiting.
Throw your back out.
Ryan Dempster will be there tomorrow, so maybe we'll have a little dueling Harry's out there at some point. There was a lot of people there, and there'll be a lot of people there tomorrow. I know Steve McMichael is going to be out there tomorrow. He wasn't there tonight, but there'll be several other people that were, that were in attendance. And it's a good time. It's an interesting tournament because they start the tournament in Evanston, they cross over into Wilmette, and then they come back into Evanston. Like three of the holes, I guess, are in Wilmette, and then you come back into to Evanston when they start out with. Yeah, so, and I've been, you know, fortunate enough to be involved in this the last 3 years, thanks to Betsy Shepard when I met her at the rally back in 2016 for the Cubs. That was at Harry Carey. She was there along with Joel Murray, and I got to talk to both of them, and I got hooked up in this, and so it's been a great time for me. I just kind of hang out on the 10th hole with the Harry Carey's
people.
Do
you?
I do me. I just stand on a, I just stand out there, and I, okay, you know, I'll do it. Nice, I just do some play-by-play of the drives that are hit, and you know, we just mingle with all the people and the actors, and because there's basically, you know, there's the first responder, and a military person, and a celebrity in each fivesome that they have out there. So it's a good group. And, you know, by the end of the day, everybody's, you know, having a good time. It's a shotgun start. I get to see them all because they come through. Kevin Butler actually had a hole-in-one a couple of years ago.
Really?
In the tournament. So it's a course that the Murray brothers.
What are they winning? You know, sometimes you could have $1 million. You win a new Buick or whatever.
Yeah, he didn't get they don't have anything if you hit a hole-in-one. I actually got one of my own in a golf outing many years ago.
Now, remember, of course, Joe Gentile, right? Yeah. He would have a golf outing that would support St. Ignatius, and there would always be the hole-in-one thing, and those were always tense moments, waiting for everyone to get through not getting a hole-in-one.
Well, you know, he's got to have insurance for that stuff to cover it, but the hole-in-one I got in my outing was I got a camcorder. Now, one of the other holes had a car. But I didn't get it on the right hole, so I missed out on that. But no, they don't. I don't think they have anything as far as prizes or anything for a hole in one. But it's a great outing. It's good to see all the first responders that are out there. It's nice to talk to them on each hole, and they come from everywhere. We've got people from New York. We got people from involved in the different. You know, there are a few different things that happened. We had with the Aurora shooting. We've got a few of the people that responded out there. They're going to be there. It's just a great outing for a great cause, and so everybody gets together and
I love Chicago. And here's part of I think what is so great about it. And we were talking a little bit about it off the air. You look at those 85 Bears, and how great is that? That they have had that opportunity to kind of share so much of the love and success and adulation. Right? I mean, you think about a moment in time that was like so big, right, for them to go ahead and win the Super Bowl. And here's part of it too, is not only were they great on the field, obviously they, you know, beat teams and won games, but there were so many great personalities there.
Yeah.
Whether it was like Super Bowl Shuffle and all of those guys, and to have them be just as like well known and beloved like today almost as they were then is really great. And then you add in, so this is Chicago, the welcoming, open arms, and the kind of celebrity-making place that we are here, that the alligator guy has now got his...
Yeah, he's apparently gotten into the circle of trust. So
did he go back to Florida at all? And he's just like, calls his wife. He's like, babe, I'm staying. This is working out.
Yeah, but they just keep giving me free stuff. I got to stick around until it runs out. But no, I don't know. It was just kind of strange that he was there. But it was... It was a good night, and it was great because, you know, everybody was accommodating. You know, if people wanted to go up and get pictures, you know, all the people, the celebrities were, you know, very accommodating. They allowed you because we're all hanging out together, and, you know, and they had Expo 76 with Doug Julin, who was involved with Poor Dog Pondering years ago. So, but it was a good time all the way around, and I'm looking forward to later on this morning.
A lot of great people. Involved.
Yep.
Great cause, and so we'll talk a little bit more about that, I'm sure, before the end of the program. We're going to take a quick break. We come back, we're going to send it to news, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the Flashback Horror Convention, and Tomasz is going to share his thoughts on that. So movies of a different kind, action of maybe a more bloody, gory, murderous kind. Who knows, right? Keep it here. Quick break, 720 WGN.
He did the Monster Mash. The Monster Mash. It was a graveyard smash. He did the It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster.
It sounds kind of innocent and less gory and scary and all the kind of things that you know was happening in quantity with Tom and Nick over the weekend. Here, 720 WGN is Dane in for Nick until 5 a.m. Dino Tiberi is to my right, and Tom Hush is in the booth. And so you get an opportunity to get over to the flashback horror convention this weekend. And these things are very popular where you have, whether it's, you know, Comic-Con or whatever kind of different kind of niche or genre that are associated with it. I think you see a lot of horror stuff at some of those as well. But this one is dedicated, right, to people who love scary movies? Or is there a difference between a scary movie and a horror movie?
Well, I mean, like, it kind of depends on how you want to define horror. Because I think sometimes people put a premium on whether or not a movie is outwardly scary insofar as it makes you jump out of your seat. Obviously, there are plenty of movies like that. But horror is a very broad genre. You've got many subgenres within that, like horror comedy. Who would have ever thought that, you know, scary movies could be funny, but you have things like the Evil Dead movies, which are...
Or Scary Movie, or then the Wayans Brothers.
Yeah, or even Scream itself, which it's parodying, is a sort of tongue-in-cheek take on the slasher genre and ended up saving slashers. Like, because when by the time you get to 1996, when Scream comes out, slashers are dead. People were tired of them. They thought they were dumb. They thought they were played out. And then Wes Craven returned to the genre that made him famous. And he flipped the script and it made slashers fun again and interesting again. So, I mean, horror movies run the gamut. Because there's a very big difference between something like A Nightmare on Elm Street or Halloween or Friday the 13th from the universal monsters that so many people grew up loving, like the Wolfman or, you know,
Frankenstein.
Yeah, James Whale's Frankenstein, which at the time were terrifying to people. No one had ever seen anything like that.
Really?
Yeah, well,
I was scared by that stuff.
Go back to you were nine, though, Dino. I mean, yeah. But back in the day, so I would love to see it. I don't know if they didn't have Rotten Tomatoes back then, and or any kind of ancient way for us to tell what people thought. But really, were, you know, so those early Dracula movies or the early Frankenstein movies, you know, they always show the townspeople with the pitchforks and the torches and things like that. So, but were the moviegoers like genuinely frightened by them?
Yeah. I mean, they were scary movies. Bela Lugosi doing his Hungarian, like, Dracula thing.
That's how, fill us in here. Was he just, did Dracula have that? Was he doing a role, or is that just the way Bela Lugosi talked?
That's how Bela Lugosi kind of talked. I mean, so he has an accent. Yeah,
come over, when he did Abbott Costello meet Frankenstein, that was a funny, scary movie at the same time, but it wasn't. But yeah, Bela Lugosi in that one.
Blah, I mean, good, blah. And so just, then everyone
the
just
prototypical, you know, Dracula.
That's because he made it, though, right?
Right, because that's how it was.
Wow.
It's so weird.
And Boris Karloff?
Yeah, Boris Karloff as Frankenstein. And he was, I believe he played the mummy at least once.
And Lon Chaney was Wolfman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, this set up our entire understanding of many of these stories. I mean, Dracula and Frankenstein are based on books, and those movies, while they're almost completely unlike the books that they're adapting, they still set up a certain visual language for us to understand the story of Dracula and the story of Frankenstein. Frankenstein's monster didn't have bolts in his neck and his skin wasn't like green. It didn't have a big tall head, but you know, that depiction of Frankenstein is so important to how so many people engage with that story.
And if they didn't have those movies, who would be watching Creature Features on Channel 9?
True.
I mean,
because, you know, they had that whole thing back in the 70s and 80s.
Well, okay. So,
scared the crap out of me when I was watching with my father.
Okay, so you've got some of your modern day, you know, like your Jasons, you know, or Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger, right? Some of your more modern day kind of stars, right, if you will, of the horror world. But then you have sort of like your, I don't know, kind of like Marvel comic kind of characters that are in that team photo of like famous, you know, like your, what is it? Would it be like Frankenstein, Wolfman, Bride of Frankenstein? You know, that was a great match made right there.
Yeah. Excellent sequel.
Wolfman. Like who? Like
the Mummy.
The Mummy, The Invisible Man.
Yeah, all those.
Those guys are all grouped together under the Universal horror movies because they were all put out by Universal Studios in the 30s. And that's your Mount Rushmore of what's considered like the golden age of horror.
Okay.
And then you move into, you know, they do golden age, silver age, bronze age, and then many people try to classify it because people like
the
to
Jurassic
make categories.
Period.
Yeah.
No,
but like people like to classify different eras of horror and try to give meaning and shape to certain movements that happened. So many people know Christopher Lee. Many people my age know Christopher Lee as Saruman in the Lord of the Rings movies, because that was his big role during the 2000s. But really, most people...
He was Dracula, right?
He was Dracula, yeah. He was in the Hammer series, and he was, if you ask me, and if you ask Nick as well, way better than Bela Lugosi. Way scarier, way more intimidating, and in, frightening color.
Now, do kind of horror fans come down much as they often do on the James Bond roles? Like, who's your favorite, or who do you think? Sure. To where people have like your modern day Draculas? Because who? What were some of the? Wasn't Keanu Reeves in a Dracula movie?
God. yeah, he was in Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was directed by Francis Ford Coppola of Godfather fame, and also One from the Heart, if you're a big fan of One from the Heart.
Gary Oldman was Dracula.
Gary Oldman was Dracula. He was the standout from that adaptation, and the movie is very competently shot and everything. It's just very poorly acted, because you've got Keanu Reeves doing possibly one of the worst British accents anybody's ever heard in a movie. Keanu Reeves isn't British, and he just didn't spend the time to learn the accent. So you've got him playing Jonathan Harker doing, I know where the bastard sleeps. Like, it's not convincing in any way, shape, or form. But he's trying, you know?
Well, it's like, you got to give him something for the effort. That's about it.
So, now, I love Indino. I'm not a huge horror movie fan, but I do... some of the scary movies I can sort of kind of get. A Quiet Place I thought was pretty good, or if it's got some sort of like, aliens, or I mentioned I did like Cowboys versus Aliens. I guess that, isn't something that a lot of people share the same opinion, but I kind of like the zombie movies a little bit, but zombie movies, Dracula is pretty, typical on the Dracula side. He wants to bite your neck, right? Right. He wants to drink you. That's what he wants to do. But the zombies can be totally different things, and I guess they're universally scary. But so the zombies,
and they're relentless, right? Just keep coming.
I think universally, right? Yes, and I will say that again, is that like that's something that all the zombies have in common, is that they just don't stop. But really, they don't. But I think their skill set, and I think their what it is they do and how they do it, really varies a lot. You've got sort of the ambling, like arms out, where you could pretty much run away from these zombies pretty easily, but you always have to watch.
And right into the arms of another one.
Well, you don't want to get caught in a corner. You don't want to be caught in a house with the zombies. And the Walking Dead, that's that kind of zombies, right? Where they're just moving around in packs. They seem to work together, or at least be okay with each other.
Right.
They're not attacking each other, and then they just kind of like moan and walk around and things like that. Whereas in some of the other movies, like Zombieland, which if you saw that with Woody Harrelson and
I did not see that one, actually. I don't know why not. It doesn't.
The zombies are fast. They're fast and scary. Or 28 days or 28 days later. Or, some of those movies where the zombies are pretty actually like scary. I like the zombie movies. I think I'm okay with that. I'm not so super great on the gory part of it. I think it's an interesting phenomenon, right? Because it's difficult for me to believe that, Dracula exists. But the zombie situation, especially when they build it into sort of a post-apocalyptic situation where like, oh my gosh, this is happening. I kind of like the zombie movies.
Well, and George A. Romero is really one of the great filmmakers of the 20th century.
Is he like Day of the Dead?
He actually invented the modern concept of the zombie. Now the word zombie existed, but what it described was it was a little bit more of a voodoo thing, not so much the living dead. So when he comes out with Night of the Living Dead in 1968, I want to say, he established what we think of now when we hear zombie. He ostensibly created the concept of the living dead in that way. And in fact, if he had not made a grave copyright error, he would have been solely credited and had to be paid every time anybody ever made a zombie movie, because he came up with the shambling corpse and the coming out of the graves thing. So, back in 68, when they would make movies, they would have to put a copyright on the title card. But they forgot to do it.
Oh, boy.
So that movie, in fact, is in the public domain. You can screen it anywhere for free. You can get a copy of Night of the Living Dead, a public domain copy, and you can screen it anywhere for free because it's part of the public domain. And that also, by extension, means that the concept of the zombie, as George A. Romero created it, is also in the public domain. So you can write a zombie movie pretty much the exact same as Night of the Living Dead, and it is totally legal.
Wow.
Legal. Let's say Star Wars, a movie with Yodas.
Yodas exactly. That's copyrighted to death. Everything in that movie has a little TM next to the name.
Yeah, right.
So, and that's what makes the zombie genre great, though, because it gives people a place to experiment and to do new takes on the genre, even though George A. Romero, he's the grandfather of the whole thing. He did Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, a few other sequels after that are kind of less well known, but that core trilogy is it's the Bible of zombie movies.
312-981-7200. Your favorite horror movie of all time? Tom and Nick got a chance to see a lot of them at this festival, and the zombie movies can come down in a bunch of on your vampires, because that's really had a few different kinds of incarnations, everything from like hello Dino, how are you doing, that guy, right, to sort of those Twilight movies where then they're all like 118 year old teenage kids in high school, right? That's what they're doing.
Sparkle.
And also too is some of the things they can and can't do, which I think is also an interesting, how do you combat them as a person trying to make your way through a world filled with, let's say, vampires or werewolves or whatever. Because, so the werewolves, we can go through some of these. So the werewolves, it's a silver bullet, right? They don't like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know, does garlic bother the werewolves or no?
No, garlic is vampires.
Right?
Vampires.
I mean, I knew that. Of course, the vampires, you've got the garlic and you've got the, and they can't see themselves in the mirror. Sunlight, right, is a big deal for them.
Bad. Anything with a cross.
Stake in the heart.
Yeah.
Well, that would go for anybody, Dino.
Well, that's true, but especially them. But some especially of them can come back if you miss.
It keeps them dead, yeah. And here it is like the kind of range of difficulty, whereas in the Twilight movies, they just, don't sparkle as much, or maybe they're a little tired in the sun, where some of them, if it even touches them, they like explode.
Yeah, there's a great vampire western directed by Catherine Bigelow, who many people know as she was the first woman to ever win best director at the Oscars for The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty. She really has a past in doing really weird genre movies, much like her ex-husband James Cameron. She made a movie back in the 80s called Near Dark, which is a vampire movie starring Bill Paxton and Lance Henriksen, who Lance was actually at Flashback Horror Weekend. Really nice guy.
Oh, wow. How cool is that?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. He's a very cool guy. And a bunch of other 80s staples that you'd probably recognize. But that one, the way they approach sunlight is probably the most messed up that they've ever done it, because they literally like catch fire and then explode.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. I'm like, give me more of that. Yeah. But, the Twilight movies, I everybody rags on them because they're melodramatic and they're kind of crappy and they're not super well acted. But you know what? It captured the hearts of like an entire generation of teens, like teen girls. And there's nothing wrong with that. They like it. It's a romance novel. Romance novels are fine.
Yeah. Yeah, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about some of that, some of the weaknesses and strengths of your favorite horror superstars and genres. And then also on the zombie side, too, some of the different ways that they've been incorporated into, whether it's post-apocalyptic plots or whether it's just some fun, right, coming out of the ground to get you. So quick break. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Is the knack, right? Okay.
My Sharona.
720 WGN. We are here.
Bring us back.
Hey, look, everybody can do the Dracula voice. 312-981-7200. I'm sure.
Tom's just shaking his head like, what are those two nuts doing in
you
there?
You sound like Count Chocula.
I like Count Chocula.
Yeah. I mean, think about that. It went all the way from what was terrifying audiences, and we had one of the texters text in that people were fainting in the theaters because it was that scary of a situation, to where it's like your favorite breakfast cereal.
Right on. Hey, Tom, I want to ask you, where did you go to see all the movies?
Well, when I was growing up, I was born in 1993, which I know a lot of people be like, oh, he's a millennial. But I still grew up in a time when going to the video store was basically my main way of seeing movies. I mean, I saw movies in the theater as a kid. My dad loved to take me. My mom loved to take me. But the video store was like my mecca. It's where I learned everything when it came to my love of movies. So usually I just like rent them. I would just like go and look and see what either when we were still in the time of VHS being really popular to the DVD era. I was just like, if it had a cool cover, I would just be like, well, I'm just going to see what this
check
is like.
Check it out and see, yeah.
Yeah, and okay. And I think in the 90s at some point, I want to say like Burger King or something, was giving out like Universal Monster toys. Okay. It's like, and I got a, you know, I got the Burger King version of a Happy Meal or whatever that is, and it came with a little Wolfman.
Okay.
And I loved it. I was like, oh man, look at this Wolfman. He's so cool. So I wanted to rent the Wolfman, and that got me down the real classic stuff. And Svengoolie came back in 95 after not having a permanent situation. So I watched Svengoolie on Saturday nights on WCIU. So.
Rich Kaz.
Yeah.
So, and I know that whether it was like your family videos or Blockbusters, they would have like a pretty extensive selection of stuff. You know, it wasn't just what was on that back wall that you'd wait, you know, the four or five copies of
the new ones that would come out
of the original Toy Story or whatever it was. You know, they have a whole bunch of different things, and you could see, and this is of course pre, you know, YouTube or being able to
streaming anything.
Nothing like that.
Well, and I think that's what really the problem is with people relying on streaming services for their main mode of entertainment. And there's nothing wrong with it. I have plenty of streaming services. I even have a horror specific one called Shudder that's put out by AMC, who does The Walking Dead and everything like that on their main cable channel. But when you rely too much on the streaming, you're really putting yourself in a rights situation. So like they're going to be introducing many new streaming services by the end of this year and going into 2020 as well. You've got Disney Plus coming out that's going to be the home of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, the Marvel movies, plus Disney's massive backlog of movies. So all that's going to start disappearing from things like Netflix or Hulu. HBO Max is going to be coming out, which is going to take away Friends from Netflix, if I'm not, I believe that's going to be HBO. So everybody's kind of splitting up, and we're going to have the same problem as we had with cable. You have to have these different packages.
Right, you're going to end up having to spend the same amount of money on all the streaming services instead of just doing it on our cable package.
Right, so I've always been a big proponent of, I buy tons of DVDs and Blu-rays because it means that I don't have to worry about whether or not that's going to be on Netflix when I want to watch it. I get a hankering to watch Casablanca or something like that for out of nowhere. I'm like, you know what? I want to watch Casablanca. So
really? Does that hanker ever happen?
Oh yeah, seriously. Sure. I love it. I love going back, watch a little Humphrey Bogart.
Oh yeah,
a little black and white action.
Yeah. It's great stuff. It's great stuff. But I would hate to live in a world where I could not find something that I really wanted to watch. And Netflix and many streaming services tend to skew very new. A lot of that stuff is released since, you know, it's from the past 20 years or so. And you'll find on Netflix, while you'll get a few gems here and there, Taxi Driver's on Netflix, Mean Streets. There's some certain stuff that is pre, like 1970. There's not a lot there. There really isn't. And there should be, because this is the way we can preserve our cultural history.
Right. Yeah, the historical value goes away with when you have such new movies that are out all the time. And
they might be good movies. New movies are good
movies.
They're
good, too. But you still, like you said, I like going back and watching some of the older ones, too, when I get the opportunity. Because it puts things, I can go back and go, yeah, I remember what was going on when I was watching that the first time through. So you just don't see it all the time.
312-981-7200, your thoughts on your favorite horror movies of all time. We did the favorite action movies, got a ton of those now. Because here's the thing, too, you can go all the way back to like your, you know, whether it's The Shining, right, or even further back to like Alfred Hitchcock and some of those things. And those are the kind of movies that actually kind of took the country by storm, where everybody was talking about it and it was like a big deal, where it wasn't necessarily just a movie for the entertainment sake. It was something that sort of shook I don't know, America to like its core in some ways, right? Just the way that they were done.
And there's a certain lack of context we have now, because we all understand Alfred Hitchcock to be like a titan of cinema. He's made some of the most important movies ever to grace the silver screen. But in his time, he was not nearly as well respected by a lot of his peers. There was a great interview with Orson Welles where he just tore right into Hitchcock. He said that Rear Window was like one of the worst movies he's ever seen. Paltry piece of cinema, all that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, you know, 50 years, 60 years later, we're talking about Alfred Hitchcock and how much something like Rear Window changed the game in terms of how a thriller would be shot. Psycho was totally lowbrow, like kind of sick entertainment for a lot of people. That Psycho, when you think about it, is a pretty lurid movie. It even holds the distinction of being the first movie to ever show a toilet being flushed, because that didn't happen in movies prior to that. But Psycho now stands up as this, like, the beginning of something new.
Yeah.
And it was bold. They killed the star of the movie in the first 30 minutes. You didn't do that. The whole idea of a movie theater not allowing you to enter into a screening after it had already started was because of Psycho. Because Alfred Hitchcock says, he's like, no, after the first, like, 10 minutes, people can't come in. Because they won't, like, if they came in 30 minutes in, they're going to be like, wait, where's Janet Leigh? She's on the poster. Where's Janet Leigh?
She's gone. The context of it.
And the people, and he said, hey, don't ruin the movie. Don't spoil it. And now we get that again in 2019 with the whole Endgame thing. Like, don't, hey, Thanos demands your silence. Hashtag Thanos demands your silence. So it set up a lot of the stuff that would become a staple of the movie-going experience.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that. Plus, we had promised we're going to get into the zombie situation, how they have kind of progressed from that origin, the start of it, to where they're always kind of scary, right? Even, you know, popular television programs, some of the biggest hits, you know, like Walking Dead, but there's still the ambling, moaning, kind of just don't let them get you caught in the corner kind of zombie, right? They're not to come chase you down in a whole entire horde like 28 days later. Those are scary. So we're going to talk about that when we come back as well. Quick break. We'll come back. We'll send it to news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Music's good, right?
It's a solid ELO song right there.
720 WGN. It is Dane here with you in for Nick D until 5 a.m. today. Allstate Skyline Studio. And Tom just got back from a convention that was based on here with some great, not only great fans of horror movies, of the horror genre, some of the stars of some of those movies were there as well. And then, of course, some of those great kind of styles and niches within that type of filmmaking represented as well. And so before we went to the break in the news, we're going to talk a little bit about zombie movies. And I think zombies can be, because of either just the nature of the way that they operate, you know, they can sort of be funny, right? Zombieland is a very funny movie. I thought that was pretty great. You know, Shaun of the Dead.
Which is, I've watched that movie a million times and it never ceases to make me laugh.
Yeah, where you have the opportunity where some of these zombies can have actual personalities and be sort of kind of fun and funny within it. But then it also has the ability, well, just like, I guess, on Twilight with the vampires, where it could be a love story, or they could be kind of terrifying. And on the zombie side, I don't think anything gets kind of scarier when the entire, whether it's that post-apocalyptic situation where the vast majority of the population of a certain area is turned into, you know, carnivorous. And if they're fast, I think that adds another element to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, some people really, they get their sticklers about fast versus slow zombies.
I mean, is it, do the people come down in one camp or the other?
Yeah, yeah. Generally, the purists, if you side with people like George Romero or Nick in this case.
So Nick is a slow zombie.
He's a slow zombie. That's what zombies are. They're supposed to be slow. They're supposed to, like, kind of crowd up on you and catch you by surprise, in a sense. Because if they're fast, it's like, yeah, so is a cheetah, you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing distinct about them. When they're slow, they're supposed to be the living dead, and that's the argument. But I don't mind fast zombies at all. I think it's cool.
Well, so where do you come down as far as some of your favorite, like, zombie, like 28 Days Later, I thought was really good. It was based on, for the listeners that may not be super familiar, I think it's based in either London or it's somewhere in
England. Yeah, it takes place in London.
And it's one of those things, whether it's like a medical experiment gone awry or something, mm-hmm. right? And then it just gets out in the world, and then the rest of us that are trying to survive it, I put myself in the us as the living person. Well, maybe some people identify with the zombies, who knows? You know, trying to survive, and these are unique. Where here's the other part of it too, and you have differences, right? Where how you get changed, right? They bite you, and then somehow you become part of that collective right. group known as the zombie, right? Zombie Nation. So, but sometimes with that movie, with 28 Days Later, it was a matter of seconds You know, it was it was like 30 seconds or something like that where you could realize you were infected, and then you had just a matter of seconds in order to before you're off chasing other people. And then some, it's like over the course of days, you know?
Yeah, there's no generally accepted timeline as to how long it should take. It's just kind of up to whoever's making the movie. And 28 Days Later is one of my favorites. That came out when I was still pretty young, maybe like 9 or 10. And it scared me immensely because, I mean, it's a people are sometimes hesitant to call it a zombie movie because they're not the living dead. They're infected,
which they get. That's an important distinction, right?
They get, yeah. I personally, I'm not as much of a stickler about it. It has the trappings of a zombie movie.
Yeah.
So, but it's, you have to think about the context in which it came out. It's, you know, post 9/11. We're seeing a world that seems to be descending into chaos, and it deals with a global, a pandemic, essentially, which is a very realistic scenario. The dead coming back to life, your mileage with that will vary in terms of realism, but an infected, someone who has a disease, spreading it via mouth and spit and blood, that's a real thing that happens. So that's why that's such an amazing take on the genre, because it says, what if we really made zombies a problem that is realistic and can really scare the hell out of our audience? And I think still to this day, even though it was actually shot on like a mini DV camera, like it wasn't shot on film. It was a digital movie shot on like a handheld camera that you could get at Best Buy at the time to give it a grittier look. And I think still to this day, it's one of the most terrifying experiences you can have when it comes to that style of movie.
Well, and it is the kind of thing that could actually happen. And you could think of things, you know, whether it's in the animal world with like rabies or something like that, where things can kind of take on a different mental state, be sort of crazy, and then be maybe hyper-violent, right? And then, in fact, you could just extrapolate ahead, especially if science is working on it, and, you know, they're trying to find the next, like, biological weapon where they just want to accelerate, you know, how things happen and how things spread. It's the kind of thing, and you know, at least you feel like you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist or whatever, that somewhere in some laboratory somewhere, they're working on all that. You know, they're trying to at least experiment with those kind of things.
It's a deep fear. It's a deep fear that people have. And it's something that we still think about today. You know, what if something happened where you're suddenly fighting your neighbor for survival because they've just gone feral? Essentially, that's all it is just a horde of feral people that you just don't know what to do about.
And some of these situations, whether it's in the television programs or the movies that go along with them, sometimes you're in survival mode, like really like literal survival mode, like you're trying to hold up and survive or escape the zombies. And then some you're kind of just maintaining, you're kind of finding this is the new path, the new life, you know, in this post-apocalyptic kind of road warrior type situation, you know, like a Walking Dead where you're building towns and whatever. And so the zombies, you know, they're kind of an occasion, I don't want to say a nuisance, but they're just kind of showing up. You know, you're not like hiding from them all the time.
Yeah, you're still living your regular life. And that was the great...
Just happened to be surrounded by zombies.
Yeah, surrounded by rotting flesh 24/7.
Right.
But that was the great promise of The Walking Dead, both as its original comic book form and as a television show, is because it answers that fundamental question of what happens once the movie's over. Like, the zombie horde is still out there. Like, the zombie thing is still happening. How do people deal with that? And how, you know, what if you had a situation where you have to rebuild society? That's the great setup of that series. Whether it's continued to live up to that initial promise, it kind of depends on who you are.
And to what level and what type of society are you rebuilding? Are you rebuilding back to caveman days, basically?
Or no electricity?
Well, no, and this just came through, too, and this is one that I was definitely going to mention from the 815, is what about World War Z, where they do take it and kind of go all the way, where they're not trying to necessarily rebuild society. They're still trying to save the world, you know, at this point. And it's very interesting, you know, where you see kind of how far things can go. And then the science community scrambling to try to find either some kind of solution or antidote for it.
And World War Z is an interesting example because it's based on a book by Max Brooks, Mel Brooks' son, in fact. And he did a couple books about, like, just kind of wondering what would happen if zombies were a realistic threat in the world today. And World War Z is originally, in its novel form, more of different stories from the perspective of people living in a world being overrun with zombies. And the movie kind of takes that initial concept and turns it into a Brad Pitt vehicle, really. And some people really enjoy it. I thought it was pretty good. But I did like that they got into this idea of the medical treatment for zombies. And it's been explored in a few different movies. Like Day of the Dead is all about the military trying to, like, kind of weaponize zombies and figure out what to do with them. Because now they're just everywhere.
Like, now go get that guy.
Yeah. They're, like, testing the brain function of a zombie. Be like, can we turn them into ostensibly slaves? And it doesn't work out super well for them, as you might expect. But, yeah, World War Z was pretty good. And, you know, the best part is that the zombie genre won't go away. They're just going to keep doing new stuff. They're going to have new takes on it. There's a new version of this called Little Monsters, starring Lupita Nyong'o and Josh Gad, who was the snowman from Frozen. He was the voice of the snowman. He was in the original Book of Mormon.
He's also in Pixels, right? He was the Wonder Kid.
Ew.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's a take where Lupita Nyong'o is leading a group of children on a field trip, and then all of a sudden, zombies. So it's like, what do you do when you have a group of children, and the whole thing is being overrun by zombies?
Brad Pitt, you mentioned a vehicle for Brad Pitt. You know, certainly one of our kind of A-list celebrities and a big star. And then you think of one where it kind of gets into that post-apocalyptic side of things, and then also a star vehicle for Will Smith. Was it I Am Legend? Was that the one where he was in New York? Was that
But those are vampires.
No, these were zombies. This was like after it was some sort of an outbreak of some kind of disease that they had created, and then he's like left on, you know, his wife and child die in a helicopter accident. It's just right. Him and a German Shepherd and these zombies, and some of the zombies, at least one of them, had become kind of smart and was starting to lead the other ones, and so there was that, and he's still searching for a cure for them, you know,
right? Yeah,
in like his basement or whatever.
Yeah. And I don't mean to contradict, but I Am Legend, it's based on the novella by Richard Matheson, and it was also made into a movie called The Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston. They're supposed to be it's a world overrun by vampires. But in I Am Legend, they play them like they're zombies.
Like, yeah, they're not like drinking blood or...
Yeah, they're...
And they don't talk at all like Bela Lugosi.
Can you imagine how much better that movie would have been? Just people in black capes running around.
I'm coming to get you.
But yeah, it's a good example of you know, the post-apocalypse thing, and it works fairly well as a horror movie. I Am Legend has kind of been notoriously difficult to adapt, even though I do like earlier adaptations of it, like The Omega Man, which have you seen The Omega Man?
No, I mean, Charlton Heston obviously
Heston.
Of course, remember him in some of his greatest lines from Soylent Green. It's people. But that's like your post-apocalyptic, or like you're near towards the edge of it. I think there's a lot of touchstones based on what we're dealing with today, where like the environment's getting ruined and the earth is getting too hot and there's no food for the people. Mm-hmm. We'll get there.
Yeah. I always like to think that horror movies, and especially like when you get into like horror sci-fi, say more about the present day than it does about the future. It's a reflection of what we're afraid of now. So say Alien, for example, you know, it's this fear of the unknown of space. In 1979, we were still pretty unsure about what was out there. You know, we had gotten to the moon. We were really starting to explore. But there was this fear about what was happening in the reaches of space. And so we get Alien. Terminator is less of a horror movie, but it still has those elements of, you know, computing is moving really fast. All of a sudden, we're able to do all these amazing things with technology. But there was a fear. What happens if the robots take over? Yeah. What happens when they look like jacked Austrian dudes and come after you from the future? From the future, man.
Oh, you got to go back in time and you got to take out John Connor. That's what you got to do.
And, you know, give birth to your own commanding officer because it's a loop. It doesn't make any sense.
You got right. You got to go back and have like the kind of the org chart. You got to get a whiteboard out so you can figure it all out. When we come back from this break, we are going to talk a little bit about some of the other ones, whether it's like this, the really gory movies, or even Rob Zombie. That's a guy that we're going to actually get a chance to interview in the next couple months. And he has, you know, a musical person, is a, you know, an artist on the musical side and a rock star, but also is a huge fan, not only to the point of liking, but also creating some of that entertainment as well. So a quick break. We'll be back with more. It's staying here on 720 WGN. Springsteen, also one of the greatest action heroes of all time when it comes to onstage stuff. 3-hour sets and shows and constantly running around and sweating. He's
a man. He is a legend. There's no question about it. I've watched him a couple times, and the times I saw him, I was amazed. Walked away, I'm like, wow, how's
right?
That guy
it's
doing?
It's nonstop
it?
Action packed, right? So 720 WGN, high atop Chicago, the Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane in for Nick D until 5. AM. And before we went to break, we talked about it on the music side. He is still out there touring. I'll get a chance to interview him on the travel side and the touring side. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the movies as well. Rob Zombie, we had some thoughts from the 301 saying Rob Zombie's movies are all garbage. So, Tom Hush, your thought as someone who's involved and interested in the genre. I mean, I think they have their place, right?
I don't disagree with 301. I'm not.
Tom's
not...
like, that was me texting him.
I've done it.
They're garbage, but yeah.
He's a very particular type of filmmaker. I respect that he's trying to do something specific. He's really trying to harken back to some of the exploitation stuff from like the 70s. So things like The Hills Have Eyes, or probably more appropriately, like The Last House on the Left or I Spit on Your Grave, which get very close to being like kind of snuff films. They're really, really lurid and very, very graphic. And I think that he's the type of guy that grew up on a lot of that. But, you know, I wouldn't say that most of his movies are for me. I think like House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects, while in title, sound like something I would definitely watch. They don't necessarily do it for me. I wasn't a huge fan of his Halloween remakes. I thought they were okay. But I appreciate what the guy's doing.
When it comes to movies that are sort of, that I feel have some of those same types of characters in them, crazy people, chainsaws, and strange conversations, like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre and things like that. So where do you put that movie in as far as like in the kind of the history? Because I think from what it was and how it was one of those that really captured, I think, the thought process of America on the horror side.
Yeah. I mean, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, directed by Tobe Hooper, is really, you could consider it one of the most important American films ever made, because what it did was introduce the what's called the cinema verite style, which is it looks like it was shot for real, like just them sitting with these people shooting what happened. And even the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was kind of pushed as like, ooh, this based on a true story thing, which yes and no. It's inspired by Ed Gein, who famously...
Famous Wisconsin resident.
Yeah, exactly. Famous cheesehead Ed Gein, who made furniture and suits out of people's skin. It's graphic. It's horrible. And it's a thing that really happened. But he inspired many of the great killers of stage and screen, including Norman Bates from Psycho, Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and a little bit of Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. So... Texas Chainsaw Massacre, though, was they did not make movies like that prior to, or at least they didn't reach that level of popularity. And one of the things that I find really interesting about that movie is people assume that it's incredibly violent, but it really isn't. You don't see a lot of what happens. It leaves a lot to the imagination. So there is a bit where a girl gets stuck on a meat hook. But you never actually see it happen. You see her hanging. You know that the meat hook's there. They show you the meat hook. They show you pick her up, but you never see like the hook going in. There's a surprising lack of blood in that movie for something called the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So for me, it ranks among like the best of slashers. If you really want to try to watch, you know, slashers for Halloween, which is, you know, coming up in a couple of months, October. Yeah, I get really into it. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a must. It's even before things like Friday the 13th or A Nightmare on Elm Street, you have to watch.
And where Texas do you Chainsaw. Okay? And on the entertainment side, and where do you come down on these? Because it isn't necessarily just either a slasher movie or something about the, you know, the chainsaws or people running, you know, sort of like the, you know, the teens trying to escape the guy in the hockey mask. Is Stephen King, right? A great storyteller and just, you know, one of the, you've got to say, one of the more successful authors of all time when you look at sort of that kind of team photo of things that he's done. And then you've got like It, you know, was one of the more recent adaptions to his work. Where do you come down? Because it's horror, right? It is.
Yeah.
Great stories, though.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not much of a, he does a lot of great what we would call just ghost stories. A lot of what he's doing is ghost stories, although he's certainly not afraid of the macabre when it comes to violence. Like Pet Sematary, which recently got readapted, is a tough book to read. Even he has said that he's like not super proud of Pet Sematary, but it's out there. It is a very disturbing movie. Misery is a really pretty disturbing movie.
Now, is that a horror movie?
Yeah. I'd call that like it. It's kind of like a thriller, but I think thrillers are horror.
Okay.
Yeah, I think people try to take away horror from being like a well respected genre. Take for example, Silence of the Lambs, which swept the major categories the year that went to the Oscars. People are kind of hesitant to call it a straight up horror movie, even though it definitely is. It's shot like a slasher and it operates like a slasher, but no, it's a thriller, you know,
it's a psychological thriller.
Yeah. It's something nice. It's something that you can, that's more respectable and not, you know, something so base as like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which never got any sort of awards recognition, despite being an incredible achievement in terms of filmmaking.
Yeah. Well, you know, and with, I think, conventions like this and opportunities for people to have these conversations, you really do get a chance to kind of give the credit that is due and recognize. And it's big business, too. Somebody's out there appreciating and watching these films. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to send it to news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN.
It's peanut butter jelly time. Peanut butter jelly time. Peanut butter jelly time.
Hi, this is internationally known television star, world famous Jeff Morrow, and you're on the road with Dane, WGN.
WGN on the road with Dane, live here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, high atop Chicagoland, and in studio, excited to have one of our favorite people, one of the country's favorite people, one of the preeminent and premier personalities in the world of not only food but fun and also funny. It is the Sandwich King himself and star of the Kitchen on Food Network, Jeff Morrow. Jeff, welcome to WGN.
Thank you, Dane. I think that was the best introduction ever.
Oh,
you've
on.
Introduced me so many times. Right. That was the most glowing.
Yeah. We tried to add a little bit
You pump me up, man.
Extra glow. But once you start getting some of those things, because we heard a little bit about, you know, that there's things in the work about a new book, right? You know,
yes.
A lot of your colleagues, a lot of the your contemporaries in the food world, you know, get an opportunity to write a book. I see it as a great thing, not only to share, you know, a little bit of the personality, the inspiration, the food set, but also it's something to sign,
yeah.
Right? So when you do an appearance,
what was I signing before? For the last 9 years, it's like they'd print out headshots or I'd have sauce bottles. Or stuff that
right.
is not as lasting and special as a book. So, listen, it's going to take well over a year yeah. and a half to get it out to everybody. But I literally kind of just recently closed the deal and working on it as we speak.
And
so.
The books are traditionally collectible, so it's something for a lot of those fans. And you have a lot of them on social media. You're super prolific. But here's the thing, a little bit of the pressure. And we talked about it, you know, when you were doing one of these speeches at one of the conventions, is that now that you are, that you're Jeff Morrow, the public version of Jeff Morrow, there's a level of expectation. You can be great on the TV side, and it's certainly a comfort zone for you. But when you get into things you're not necessarily used to doing, people still expect it to be great. And once they send you that, you know, whatever that advance check is, there's going to be a book. Whether it's going to be a good book or not is up to you, right?
Exactly. I have to be accountable, right? But yeah, I just can't. Maybe that was the stress of waiting to, you know, start writing the book. I wasn't ready. Maybe just mentally, and maybe my career wasn't at the right place. Now I have the accountability, but I also have a local team that right. I know is a great photographer and a great food stylist and people I put together over the last couple years that now I'm ready. I have the manpower and I have, you know, the knowledge and, of course, the wealth of recipes, right? Because that's, I mean, it's 100 recipes. It's not easy to write.
And I'm sure on the travel side and just the friend side, I'm sure in the back of your mind, you're kind of cataloging some great things. Like, oh, that would be awesome. Or, yeah. Oh, that's a great thing. And maybe put your own spin on it and make a Chicago spin. So we're looking forward to that on the book side. It's going to be really great. And so let's talk a little bit about Jeff Comedy Jam. So this is, and for the listeners out there that know you solely as that personality they see on Food Network, your path towards notoriety, towards household name-dom, has been kind of a path that really has veered maybe more into comedy than it was on the food side, maybe equal, right? It's been there.
For sure. You know, just from being young and doing Second City, as young as third, fourth grade, you know, Piven Theater Workshop, Players Workshop, Groundlings in L.A. You know, I was always involved in improv or stand-up comedy in my 20s or just being funny. You know, it was always a skill I was trying to develop on stage with a microphone or with characters.
Now, do you attribute to some of it's all natural. I think you got to be hardwired to do it. It isn't one of those things that you can kind of just read a book or go to take an online course and just be funny, right? It's something that's in you. But do you attribute? I do. I think it's part of the measure of success. There's a lot of personalities that come in and out of whether it's the food space or the food world or those channels, right? And they don't always stick regardless of how much talent they may have on the food side. I think the personality is a big part of it.
I think so. You know, you just, especially this day and age, there's so much competition where a lot of the talent has lasted for so long, you know what I mean? And it's still the same top ones to kind of break through and get notice among those greats, especially Food Network talent, yeah. The guys and the Bobbies and the Jadas and the Eltons, people that have been around for decades now,
right?
It's hard to break through that, right?
And you're just naming notice. Off the pantheon,
exactly.
Right? The Mount Rushmore.
They're not going anywhere and they haven't gone anywhere. Right. So how do you stand out? So me, it was like, if I could be the funniest one out of all them, not the fastest cook, not the greatest scientific knowledge of food, not the hottest, you know, well, we're working on that, baby. But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So I could be the funniest and that's my niche. I don't know. For me, it's always been this muscle I had and it's been slowly, I've been working it out my whole life. So why not flex it cooking?
Well, here's part of the trappings, I think, of what it is that you get to do is you do get to travel, see the country, whether it's at a convention or something in Toronto, right? You get to see Toronto or whether it's with the family and you do share a lot of that on social media. And you share a lot of the experiences, kind of the family fun, some of the locations, and they are great. And so we cover and highlight transformative travel on a regular basis. But talk a little bit about that, kind of the fun of getting out there and kind of seeing the world with the family.
I love traveling. I travel almost every week, especially for work. I'm on the East Coast a lot. We shoot The Kitchen in Montclair, New Jersey. So I go out there. And when I travel for work, right, it's work. It's, you know, I'm hustling and I'm getting things done. But just this summer alone, I've been to Mexico, Nigeria, Toronto, and then Africa, South Africa, Botswana, Namibia,
how is that Doha. For work?
That's not for work, but all those.
The Serengeti to table menu for the next one.
I did not work in Africa, but I did work in Nigeria. I did a food festival out there.
Wow.
Went to Mexico for pleasure. Been, you know, the East Coast. I've been so many places this summer, and I'm a very, very fine-tuned traveler where I micromanage everything. So it's not like I have a team booking my travel. It's right. Like I must know every seat, every plane, every minute, every reservation, everything. So I'm pretty anal. But Africa, to me, has been the greatest trip of my life thus far with my family. It was phenomenal.
For the listeners out there that hear about some of these destinations, we cover a number of them. Like, what? Because that is such a mysterious place, a daunting place, an intimidating place in a bunch of different ways. People hear about either shots you got to get or being eaten by a lion. We've all seen the YouTube videos. It's like, it does, like, the experience itself. It seems like it's worth it, whatever hoops you jump through.
You know what? It's cliche to say it's a magical place that changes you. You know, it's this country that nothing feels like. And you can't compare it to anything. And I, hook, line, and sinker, man. I've been back for 3-4 weeks. I don't even know. I can't stop thinking about it hourly. We saw so much and we met so many great people and had so many great meals and saw so much of the country that, you know, with my family, that were like, we didn't even like fight the whole time. It was just magical. It was great. It was like everything came together, all the 100 hours of travel it takes to get there. And through the country, and you're on crossing four borders in one day is not easy with a 10-year-old. But man, we did it, and it was awesome.
Here for those thrill seekers out there, some of them like skydive, bungee jump, do all those kind of things. I saw some of the posts on social media where outside of the sliding glass door did not look reinforced or anything like that. There's like a leopard or something like that. And so, what is that like? You know, we've all been to the zoo, right? But we're obviously separated from the animals. Is there something that's like primordial, hardwired into you that says like? Like, you naturally know in your DNA that that is a thing that's going to eat you.
It's so funny. It was our first night out in the bush, right? And we stayed at a couple places, but this is the only one with a sliding glass door and tent. You know what I mean? It was a tent, but with a sliding glass door, mind you. So there was tent all around us. So I hear rustling. And I'm like, oh, God, what is that?
Is right? A raccoon in the garbage?
Yeah, right. That's all that we're used to, right? A raccoon in the garbage is my baseline for, it's my frame of reference for animals at night.
Wildlife danger.
Right? That in the raccoons, especially, you know, close to the city, are just give zero F's, and they have balls of steel, right?
Exactly.
So I heard rustling, and then I look, and it was then my son, who couldn't sleep. He was in the bed next door, and he's like, oh, can I sleep with you? I'm like, of course, we're in the middle of the bush, and there's all these noises. Of course you can sleep with us. So then I think I'm hearing him again, but then I hear like a, and I'm like, what's that? And 10 feet from the foot of our bed is the sliding glass door. And I pull back like the mosquito curtain, right? Because all the beds are draped in
and
mosquito.
And it's not a mosquito.
Yeah. It's definitely not a mosquito, nor a raccoon, nor a possum, nor a couple, you know, squirrels or even a deer. This thing was a giant male spotted leopard staring right at me. And you can go to Jeff, you know, at Jeff Morrow on Instagram and see the footage from there.
Yeah.
And then I have to wake up my son and my whole family because this is unbelievable. So what do you do, right? What do you do?
Like,
I'm freaking out,
wake
man.
Up, it's time to get eaten.
I was like, guys, look. And Sarah, my wife, is like, oh my God, don't open it. Don't. I'm like don't open it.
Right,
I'm
exactly.
Like, let me just get it. Let me just pull your tail really quick. Maybe throw you some of the free nuts they gave us
in a
pillow mint. And my son is, God love him, he's so like sensitive. We call him Father Lorenzo. He's like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. You know, the romantic. And I'm just like ecstatic. I'm a giant animal nerd. I love animals. I went to Africa to experience animals in their wild habitats. I'm not a fan of zoos. I'm not a fan of Disney, any of that stuff. What I've never seen I love seeing deer on Thatcher Road driving to Oak Brook, which happens all the, you know, driving to O'Hare.
Yeah, it's wild.
It tickles me.
Right.
So here we are looking at this giant beast, right?
Yes.
Obviously something that can kill you. I didn't care it could kill me.
Like its whole job is to kill you. Like,
and it does a really fine job of killing when it's time to kill.
Right.
But so what do you do, right? So I recorded it and I experienced it. And then I shut off the camera and I watched it. I watched it on my own property, right? 45 minutes. It was phenomenal. And that was it. And that to me, I was like, changed my DNA, I feel like.
That's an amazing experience. It's the kind of stuff that I don't know that you can even necessarily sign up for, even if you're doing a safari where you're in a Jeep. This was some of those things that just kind of happened. But like you said, it's a place where that's at least a possibility. And thank God everybody came out. Okay. We've got a couple minutes and I wanted to talk a little bit about Pork and Mindy's, right? So this has been a passion. This has been a drive in the restaurant business. We know this, working in and around it for so many years. It is one of the toughest businesses out there. I mean, it is hard to be successful when you have everything going for you.
Oh man.
And then to have, you know, something that's so passionate, that's, you know, your name, that's you, that's all about it. I think it raises the stakes. But now when it comes to, I guess, people's access to it and taking that great stuff that you're making and having it be more available to more people. This Mariano situation is just amazing.
Yeah, it's really been great for us. We are very proud of what we've accomplished in such a short time. You know, the restaurant business, like you said, is fickle. It's extremely hard to get, you know, earn a buck in it. It's hard to staff it. It's hard to do everything. So I'm learning, you know, a lot of us are learning as we go and we're trying to expand while having this authority and trying to feed as many people as possible. So you get that out of the way and then you partner up with Mariano's and it gives you a whole new audience that not many people have had. And there's no really guidebook for, there wasn't even a word for what we're doing. And it's called grocerants.
Yeah. Well, I think it takes a lot of the moving parts that are so difficult about the restaurant, and it makes those easy. It's a great partner to have. Allows you to sit down, do what it is that you do on the food side, and kind of focus on that, and then really kind of bring in what it is that you do and have as your superpower, which is this platform, right, to be able to share what it is that kind of do on the marketing and messaging side. I think it's an amazing relationship, and we'll have links up at WGNradio.com. I know we're a little bit tight on time, so Jeff, if people want to follow your adventures, and they are adventures, where can they go on social media?
At Jeff Morrow for all my personal adventures, for all the restaurant adventures at Pork and Mindy's. Go to porkandmindy's.com for a list of all of our Mariano's locations and beyond. So thank you. It's always great.
Great seeing you, and thanks for taking some time jumping on the show today.
I love you, Dave.
Nice. 720 WGN is...
You can't get enough of that at 4:50 in the morning. No. Why not?
Well, think about it. There's still people probably imbibing all over the place trying to end their week on a high note with a little bit of tequila. Not us, though. You know, we're seriously doing this high atop Chicago in the Allstate Skyline studio in for a handful of minutes. And Dino, you were with a number of the 85 Bears, right? Some of the Bears?
There were a couple there. Just it was a few, and then we'll see another one later this morning when Steve McMichael joins the fray. So
that's right.
Yeah, Mongo, he's 2 years ago. They have live karaoke at the end of the, once we're done golfing, they have like an informal food, and then, you know, you have live band behind
you. Live karaoke as opposed to the recorded karaoke?
Well, no, but I'm saying there's a live band behind you, not recorded music.
Oh, you're not just reading it off.
Right.
Okay.
You still have the words, but they're playing the songs live.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, he sings a song. Then I go up there, and I think I sang like Sweet Caroline, and I didn't know he was behind me. He was background vocaling for me, and I had no idea that he was even there. When I got done, he just looked over and he's like, "You didn't know I was on there, did you, Dino?" I was like, "What the?" Yeah, I had no idea, Steve.
Okay, well, see, that's the trappings. When you get to the success, the level of success, the legendary success that they got to, you can still, you know, be doing karaoke afterwards, singing Islands in the Stream with a Dino Tiberi,
sure,
right, at a golf outing. And so this year's Bears team, I think people feel it, right? There's so many things lining up on the calendar, right? It's the 100th. Anniversary of the team. You know, they seem to have, now that they've gotten rid of Cody Parkey, so it seems as though that they can maybe kind of shore up that angle of things. And
yeah,
they got some draft picks, and they got the coaching staff. Ryan Pace looks a lot smarter with Coach Nagy there, and this could be the year.
Yeah, this team has got all the things, all the ingredients are there. It's staying injury free as much as you can in that sport is key. And then just doing your job within the division like they did last year, as they were, I believe they were 5-1 in their division. So, you know, that sets up for some good things. I'm still a little concerned about the offense. I think Mitch is going to be better this year. They had a lot of games last year that were, you know, they didn't score a lot of points in their defense, and their special teams helped them early on, especially, you know, the 12-4 record notwithstanding, they had a great season. The schedule's a little bit more difficult this year, so, you know, if they go to 11-5 or 10-6, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. But I also think they could be, you know, there's people picking them to get to the Super Bowl. I, you know, maybe getting a little ahead of ourselves at that point, but
why? I think it's, I mean,
but you look at the NFC, it's wide open. They could have been there last year had they made a kick and gone, you know, through the Rams or the Saints in the next game, whoever it was.
Yep.
And, you know,
it seems like, you know, in the NFL, it isn't necessarily like it used to be where you had these, you know, dynasty type teams. Certainly, you know, the Patriots somehow find a way to win no matter what kind of thing. But where I think you can, you know, it takes a couple years to like ramp up, make some moves, and then kind of get poised for it. And anything can happen if you got the team and the ball kind of bounces your way a little bit. You had, I think, Ryan Pace, you know, came in as a wonder kid. You know, he was like, okay, he's young, he's got some great ideas. A couple big gambles that were seen as big gambles. Are they going to pay off or not with the Mitch Trubisky and moving up and all that?
Yeah.
And then you've got Khalil Mack. That's not a gamble there, but it's the kind of thing that has really, like, paid some amazing dividends. And the team seems – and those are key positions, right? And you've got – so you've got one of the best, if not maybe the best, defensive player in the game. And who's playing that? He's walking that walk. And then on the quarterback side, Mitch Trubisky, you know, he's got all the tools, right?
Well, you know, here's the thing. He's, you know, second year in the same offense. He's got the same guys coming back. receiver-wise, they drafted a running back. They made a Jordan Howard got traded to Philadelphia. They picked up a running back in the draft. They also picked up a running back in free agency. Tariq Cohen's still there. So there's a lot of weapons. You know, the tight end position's been a little bit of a question mark, but if Trey Burton comes back healthy, he's certainly going to help that as well. So, and defensively, they're one of the top teams in the league, so there's no question about how that side of the ball is going to be. It'll be a little bit of a difference with Vic Fangio being gone and Chuck Pagano taking over, but I also think they may be a little more aggressive than they were last year as far as, you know, blitzing and doing some exotic things on the defensive side, where, you know, Vic may have been a little bit more of a conservative play caller when it came to that part of the
and Pagano's team. Good though. I mean, yeah, so this
Chuck's
isn't
good.
Like
there's no question about it.
It's not like
it.
You lost your guy and now no. What are you going to do? I mean, this
right. I mean,
still
he's
good.
The guy's been a coach for a long time. He's been a head coach for a long time. You know, so there's some big things, and their exhibition season starts this week. So, you know, it's time to get the ball rolling.
It was nice to hear for the first time in a long time last year. You, Dan Hampton, and Ed Obradovich, like the whole. Usually the shows where it was an hour straight of like, what are they doing out like there?
Blood pressure 180 over 120.
Oh my gosh!
I was must listen radio though. I have to say that Mark Carmen, poor
how
guy,
stupid
just sitting
can
there
you
watching.
Be? Right, yeah, it was just like just, that was the whole show.
Playing traffic cop in there, but yeah. So that's. But, you know, the Bears, it'll be good. You know, between them and the Cubs, it's there's some. And then you've got the White Sox in there, too. So it's, you know, sports right now, it's a good time of year because you've got baseball in full swing. Football's getting ready to get started.
Full swing. So. There's no pun intended there. So you,
that's right.
Kicking off the season, Bears versus Packers. You got that rivalry between the states and the border to the north. And I know you wanted to mention this weekend, the Cubs sweeping the Brewers, that's a statement, right? Because this is the new rivalry, right?
Put some distance between them. They're four games out now. The Cardinals have dropped back a game and a half behind the Cubs. So a lot of changes being made in the last, you know, right at the trade deadline. They picked up five different players between Kimbrel and the four they got at the trade deadline. So there's a, you know, a fifth of their regular roster has been turned over in the last, you know, week and a half. So. Now these guys are going to help out, and you know, hopefully they get in a good run here. I'll be watching in Cincinnati come Thursday and Friday. I'll be live at Great American Ballpark watching from a few rows behind the Cub dugout.
You'll be live at the 11th hole today, and I'm sure you'll be channeling Harry Carey like you're about to right now with your prediction for whether it's like the Cubs and the White Sox. Of course, Harry was a voice of both sides of town. So what would he say?
Well, I think right now as we get into the last part of the season, we've got about 50 game left. And it's the Sox are going to be looking to the future to try to find out who's going to be on their roster next year. The Cub will be trying to make a push for the playoff. And I think that's where the focus will be for both ball club as we move into the last part of the season.
All right, last part of the show here, too. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to send it to news. Get ready for opening bell. 720 WGN.